and welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, going to talk about some new interesting news out on the lottery privatization scheme. How much is it going to cost us? Well, looks like a lot for nothing. Also going to talk about Bob Casey coming around on gay marriage. And I've got stories of workers taking to the streets and to the restaurant to stand up for workers' rights. In the third hour, I'm going to talk to a couple of workers that I met, conversations that I had while in Charleston, West Virginia yesterday, while the big rally there in Charleston for the United Mine Workers. And you know, this just absolutely blows my mind. And I'm going to talk about it probably a good portion of the tonight because it's really what's happened for the last 30 years. And maybe this is one of those moments where we wake up. Maybe this is one of those moments where this is that one thing where people go, oh, I get it. Maybe this is that moment of clarity. Maybe there will be an epiphany. I've said this about a lot of things. The hope is that people wake up and say, you know, enough is enough already. But yesterday in Charleston, West Virginia, there were somewhere between 7,000 to 10,000 people in the streets. I mean, it was a huge number of people who filled up the Civic Center there in Charleston for one simple cause. These coal companies had made promises to their retirees that if you give us the working years of your life, if you produce our coal, if you go thousands of feet underground and you break your back and you break your knees and you ruin your lungs and you ruin your health, that when you and if you get to retirement, you're going to be taken care of. A pretty simple promise. It says, you know what? Yes, you're going to be in dangerous situations. Yes, you're going to be in a health risk environment. And yeah, you're probably going to end up with bad lungs and bad kidneys and bad backs and bad knees and bad hips and the whole nine yards. We know that. But we're going to make sure that you get the care. And this was negotiated for years. This is what the Mine Workers Union negotiated from back in the 40s. And now you've got these companies who say, we don't want to do it anymore. And what they did, and it's really, you know, it's nothing new. We've seen these stories time and time again. We've seen these big corporations set up shell corporations, shift off their liabilities, spin them off to die. In fact, we had just gone through a presidential election where the Republican candidate, that's where he made his money. He made his money creating these companies, saddling them with debt, spinning them off to die, and then taking huge fees, well, to run them through bankruptcy. And when you run them through bankruptcy, you get to do away with all of those costs. You know, those workers. And I look at this, and for those who don't know, there was a company set up back, I think it was somewhere 2007, 2008, they set up this company, Patriot Coal. Peabody Coal Company, one of the biggest coal company in the country, set up this Patriot Coal Company, and I love that. You gotta love the name, because, well, who could be, you know, it's Patriot Coal, it's good for America, it's good for everybody, it's wonderful, it's Patriot. Could have been Liberty, could have been any of those names, but in looking at what they did, they shifted 40% of their legacy, 40 to 45% of their legacy costs, being the pensions, being the health care of their retirees. Now understand, 90% of the people that they shifted to this Patriot Coal Company, this company they made out of whole cloth, they just, yeah, well, we're going to start this. We're going to start it up and we're going to shift 90% of the people there who are already retired. And we're going to shift those 40-45% of the liabilities. We're going to shift that over. So we're going to saddle this company, this new company, with 40-45% of our legacy costs. It's going to save us, Peabody Coal, all of this. We're going to shift it off over there. And what we're going to give them is we're going to transfer, You know, I think it was the number was something along 1.2 million tons of coal reserve, which would have been a transfer of, you know, a value of about 11% of Peabody's wealth. Transferred 11% of their wealth and shuffled off up to 45% of their liability. Think about, because that's important. So you have this entity over here, and it's all the union companies, they shifted into this one. You know, because the idea is, well, we're going to cut them off to die, and we're going to run them through bankruptcy specifically to screw the workers and destroy their unions and their contracts. They also, if that wasn't bad enough, that Peabody set up Patriot to offshoot Patriot's thing, well, Arch Coal was doing the same thing with a company called Magnum Coal. So they did the identical same thing, set up this other little offshoot, and then Patriot bought Magnum, and so you see where this is going. They've set this entity up with all of this pension obligation, all of this healthcare obligation, with virtually no ability to survive. And guess what happens? I mean, you don't even need to guess. You know. The company starts losing money. They start to losing money, as it's supposed to do, as it's designed to do. They set this up specifically to fail. And why? Well, you can get 45% of your legacy costs wiped away. You run it through bankruptcy court, just wipe it away. Because that's what the bankruptcy courts do. And this is what had the right wing so crazy about the auto bailout. How dare Obama save those workers' pensions? Now, they took a major haircut. They had major concessions to their contracts. Major across, but they didn't lose everything. This is what we're talking about here. And while I was at the event yesterday, they had signs that they were handing out, and one of them really, this should be the clarion call of yesterday's rally. The question is, are you next? Because if they can get away with this with workers who have a voice, have a union, have the ability to muster 7,000 to 10,000 people to get out in the streets, what are they going to do to you by yourself? And I look at the past 30 years, and you look at all of the gamesmanship, and you look at how the bankruptcy code has been used to screw all of us, not just union workers, but all of us. And this is where I say, you know, at some point, we've really got to go, there are a handful of people in this country who basically carry the moniker CEO or executive or that are really screwing things up for everybody. And I go back to the Romney presidency, his call to be president. Think about what he did. Think about how he made his millions. And think about what he wanted for Detroit. Because while you may go, Rick, you know, that's just some coal miners. Yeah, it's not a big deal. It's going to be all of us. Because I see the exact same thing, and I've been saying this for a while, the exact same thing set up for state workers, for teachers, for cops, for firefighters. I see this coming, the same MO. When you hear people say, well, we want to run government like a business, what they really want to do is do this. You create a situation, and they've done it. The Grover Norquist model of, you know, make government so small you can drag it in the bathtub and drown it. It's what we're seeing across the board, what we're seeing in Harrisburg, and what we're seeing in Washington with the Republicans, with all this austerity. You're setting up and you're creating a situation where the pensions system is not possibly able to succeed. And they're doing this on purpose. You know, a lot of people say, well, no, you know, it just happens, you know. No, this is by design. None of this stuff happens by accident. This stuff is well thought out, well plotted out. Now, half of these politicians may not know what the plan is. They are just the tools who enact this stuff. But the very wealthy people in this country who plan 25, 50 years down the road, they know exactly what they're doing. So in 2007, when they started this Peabody Coal Company, when they started this Patriot Coal Company, do you think they knew what they were doing when they shifted the, what, 90% of the workers into the, who had never even worked for the company? who were pensioners. Do you think they thought of, hey, we're going to screw these people out of their pension, we're going to be able to give ourselves huge bonuses? You bet your ass they did. You bet they did. And the fact that they undercapitalized this tells me that absolutely. So the question then becomes, what do we do? Because, you know, I don't know if you saw the story yesterday in Stockton, California, where a bankruptcy judge said that the city, you know, could go forward with its bankruptcy, was eligible for court protection from its creditors. Hasn't decided what's going to happen with the workers' pensions, which are constitutionally protected. That sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? Because we've got a governor who keeps saying, well, you know, I can change those pensions without violating the Constitution. So this case in Stockton is going to be very important. Because what happens? What happens if the court rules that, you know what, the bondholders, that they're protected over the workers? Because that's how it works in corporate America. That's how the privatized world works. The shareholder is sacrosanct. We make them whole first. And then if there's anything left, any crumbs left for you at the bottom, maybe you'll get some of that. Quite often not, you're not. And, you know, I look at this, and I go back to this whole Tea Party thing. And I want my Tea Party friends to know I'm thinking of you. Because I know that the whole taxpayer thing is important to you, and it's important to me. What happens with this Peabody, the Patriot Coal situation, Peabody setting this up, designed to shift that risk onto the backs of the taxpayers? This is what corporate America has been getting away with for years. So when they do away with those pensions, and ask anybody who worked for Bethlehem Steel or U.S. Steel or any of those big steel companies who they ran through bankruptcy, what happened to their pensions? They ended up on the back of an organization known as the PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is a federal entity, which everybody who has a pension fund is supposed to pay into to keep it solvent. The problem is what we've allowed to happen, we've allowed these companies to shirk their responsibilities, run away with huge amounts of profit and huge bonuses, and shifting that risk, that responsibility, onto the backs of not just the workers, but the taxpayers. Because understand, the people who get screwed in this, first and foremost, are those frontline workers. And I know a bunch of people who were steel workers years ago who saw their pensions, the things that they were betting on, that they were saving for, so that they would have some reasonable retirement, they saw their pensions cut by 60%. Think about that. While the company walked away and gave themselves bonuses. Look at American Airlines right now. How American Airlines got to go through bankruptcy with some $4 billion in reserve, I have no idea. But it is time to look at these bankruptcy laws, and it's time to start thinking about, you know, who's really important in all of this? Do we make is the bondholder, is the shareholder, are they sacrosanct? Or should we say, you know what? We need to put workers ahead of them. Sorry. They created the wealth. Yeah, you may have invested some money in to help the company go, but these are the people whose blood, sweat, and tears and their lives were part of this. Maybe we should think about that. But I'm still hoping that this will be that moment where people wake up and go, you know what, we've got to do something. I'm still hopeful. I've got to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
1,000 Las Vegas taxi drivers represented by IPTEU OPEIU Local 4873 remain on strike as tensions rise on the picket lines. The union says a driver that crossed picket lines recently assaulted a striking driver at the Yellow Checker Star Transportation Headquarters in Las Vegas and was issued a citation for battery. IPTEU 4873 President Dennis Arrington called on the company to take control of any drivers who cross the picket lines and make sure this kind of behavior stops immediately. Sam Moffat is chief union steward for the drivers at Local 4873. He says the union is ready to bargain a fair solution to the strike, but the company is trying to impose its own terms.
The company declared shortly after we rejected their last proposal, 70% of our membership rejected their proposal. The company then implemented their final proposal and declared that we were at an impasse and they were not discussing any more to do with the contract.
Activists in 10 states handed out Don't Do Coke flyers at supermarkets to highlight what they say are the negative impacts the billionaire Koch brothers are having on American democracy. It was part of the Big Apple Coffee Party's Don't Do Coke campaign. The campaign is suggesting alternatives to products made by Coke companies. The United Auto Workers Union has been steadily adding members since 2009. The union's active membership in 2012 stood at 382,513. In 2009, the UAW had 355,191 members. The union says these Labor Department numbers actually don't reflect the true total number of workers represented by the UAW because workers who have organized but don't yet have their first contracts aren't counted. Academic workers in the UAW who have not yet signed membership cards are also not yet counted. When those workers are counted, the UAW says its active membership is more than 400,000. A sanitation strike in Ohio is growing as more Teamsters honor picket lines. Jesse Russell reports.
A garbage strike in Elyria, Ohio, expanded on Monday with additional Teamsters honoring the picket line of Local 377. The sanitation workers are striking Republic Services Allied Waste in Ohio, protesting alleged violations of federal labor laws. Since the strike started, Republic workers in other cities, including Evansville, Indiana, and Urbana, Illinois, have stopped work in solidarity. The workers allege that Republic has refused to provide information related to bargaining and has changed working conditions without negotiations. Republic has said negotiations are stalled over an offer to switch workers from a pension fund to a 401k. 2012 was a volatile year for the company and the workers. In early 2012, sanitation workers in Mobile, Alabama, went out on strike, alleging that the company refused to honor their contract. Later that year, Evansville, Indiana, saw a six-week-long work stoppage when Republic locked out workers.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hey there, fellow working-class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The cuts, the tax cuts.
But usually I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis just like every other state just about has a pension crisis.
You've had success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced two previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
I guess the question is, if that success, you look at his approval ratings, the people are not happy. And, you know, the balanced budgets came off the backs of the most needy. You look at the 41,000 people that immediately kicked off of adult basic, the 88,000 kids kicked to the curb off the CHIP program, off the Medicaid, and all of the money that we've given to big corporations at the expense of investments in our state and in our future. And I've got to be honest, you know, I'm a fan of getting rid of this guy and giving someone else a shot. And today, the Democratic side of the gubernatorial issue, well, one more person has thrown his hat into the ring. And I've got former Revenue Secretary Tom Wolf on the line who today announced he was in. Tom, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks, Rick. It's great to be here.
Pretty big leap deciding now you're going to throw your hat into the ring. This is a big commitment for you and your family. How did you come to it?
Well, actually, it's not that big a leap. I've been involved in community, regional, and state activities for most of my adult life, ever since I moved back to York County, back home, in the 1970s. I've been engaged in civic activities, was involved in a whole bunch of different blue ribbon committees, commissions, and panels under different Democratic governors since the 1980s. And I've always really cared about the place I grew up in. So this really isn't that big a leap for me after all. I mean, obviously running for a statewide office is a big change over being chair of a regional public broadcasting company. But I have done things in the community, in the state, in the region. And so I don't think this is a big deal. What really drives me is the thing that I think you said drives you. And it's the concern about the direction Pennsylvania's taking. We're much better than what we have right now, and I'd like to do what I can at maybe a bigger level than I've ever been at before, but basically do the same kind of thing in making Pennsylvania the kind of place that's good for everybody who lives here, not just for a few special interests.
Because you've truly got experience, and you know, I look at the company that you run that you've turned around. I know you had sold it, and then it had some problems, and now you've turned that around, and it gives me the hope that there's some experience at turning things around, because I look at the destruction of the last couple of years. The lack of investment, and really the lack of investment of the last decade or so, we've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, and I don't really understand how you can make anything work if you don't invest in it. I understand that you go through tough times. Obviously, we went through a tough time. That's why I came back to the business 4 years ago. But the answer was not to keep cutting back. It was to do what you had to do to make ends meet. But then figure out how you take a company that was sort of on its back and make it do good things. And
so austerity, and I think, austerity not the direction.
No, austerity's not the direction. I mean, that's sort of like saying to a family, you know, you're going to have to cut back. We're not going to have as much overtime as we used to have, so we're going to cut out 3 days of eating. No, you change your meal habit. Maybe you do some innovative things. You learn to eat different things, but you don't cut out 3 days of eating or 15. I don't, you know. And I think that's what this governor is doing. We need to reinvest. We need to make sure that we're investing in the things that will make Pennsylvania the kind of place we all want it to be. And that can happen regardless of what the economy is doing.
So let me ask you, on the infrastructure front, the governor came out and said $1.8 billion over the next 5 years on infrastructure spending that his own commission said was we had a $6.5 billion need over that time period. Is that investing in our future? Because to me, it doesn't look like we're even keeping up with keeping our structurally deficient bridges deficient.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much of a deficit that is. You know, $6 billion is the right number, $8 billion or $4 billion. But what he's talking about just doesn't seem like enough. And I don't think that's just, you know, mathematics. That's people who drive on the roads today in Pennsylvania, people who drive across our bridges, you just see that. You know, we have to make investments in this infrastructure, or we're not going to have the state we want to have.
Now, here we are. I mean, the reality is there's still no transportation bill, yet we're still bickering over privatizing a state asset like the wine and spirit shops or trying to figure out how to scheme off the lottery. I'm sure you saw the report, almost $3 million in consultant fees to hock off the lottery.
Yeah, I don't understand this whole privatization binge at all, but I certainly don't understand it at a time when we have much bigger issues that we have to deal with. Again, I ran the lottery. I was on your show a couple of weeks ago, and I don't understand. I just don't get it. I don't get the privatization urge. When I was there, obviously there were things we could do to make it better, and we did. But none of those things included privatizing the lottery, and I think the same thing's true of the state stores.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much we could be doing without handing it off for peanuts, and it's really what they're expecting to get for it is peanuts. Let's talk about the vision then. I guess the first question I would have for you as governor, do you take the Medicaid expansion money? I know this is Corbett's decision, but would you take it?
Sure. I mean, I would take whatever. First of all, I mean, I think. I would look at any reasonable allocation of funds from the federal government to Pennsylvania and try to figure out ways to make that happen. But second of all, we actually need a healthcare system. I'm in business. I've been in business all my life. And I come to these so-called progressive ideas from a very practical point of view. I need a good healthcare system in this state and in this country. I need good roads and bridges. I need a good education system. Those are the things, those are the kinds of investments it takes to build good jobs. So, yeah, I think we ought to be taking that and going beyond that in terms of making healthcare work.
So do you see it as the wrong direction of what our governor has done? Because in his State of the State speech, he said, you know, we're within a day's drive of 60% of the population, and there were, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of commerce that comes through, and if we don't take advantage of it, we're going to fail. Yet he's not invested in education. He's not invested in infrastructure. What he's invested in is handing out millions and millions and hundreds of millions of dollars to corporations that it doesn't seem to be helping us much.
Yeah, no, I find myself astonished to say I agree with him. We are in a good location. Pennsylvania is a wonderful location. This is why the headquarters of my company is here. We do business in 27 states, and this is a very central place. It's in the middle of one of the richest markets, if not the richest market in the world. It's a great place to do business. In spite of Pennsylvania has not been an engine of economic development, of job creation, in this, especially in the last couple of years. And I think there's really no excuse for that. One of the things we could do, aside from just appreciating the great resources we have, including our location, is to invest in the things businesses, people need their government to invest in.
So let me ask you, because I saw a thing just the other day. I mean, under this governor, we have fallen to, I think it's 46th in job creation.
Mm-hmm.
How much of this is related to his policies, and can you blame any of this on the recession? I mean, we've gone from 7th in job creation to 46th.
Yeah, I think you can. I mean, obviously, you can blame some of this on the recession, but there is really. I mean, I look at the attributes of a place like Pennsylvania, and there's no reason why we can't buck the macroeconomic trends. Why can't, if any state in the United States is going to build jobs, I think Pennsylvania is one of those places that can do it. I've built jobs since I came back 4 years ago through the recession. There are more people working at Wolf now than were working there when I first came back. So the recession is a reason, but it should not be used as an excuse as to why job creation just has not been there in Pennsylvania.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Tom Wolf, former Revenue Secretary and recent entree into the Democratic gubernatorial race. Do you have a website up yet, Tom?
I do. TomWolf4PA.com.
And we'll make sure we get a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Tom Wolf's name. It'll take you right there. You know, and Tom, in looking at that concept of bringing business to the state, because, you know, I talk to people who look for locations, you know, where they're going to relocate business, and they always say, you know, the top three things are location, location, location.
Mm-hmm.
But also in that comes education and infrastructure and all of those things. And I look at the last 2 years of our governor's budget, a $1 billion cut to public education each of those years. I look at the 20,000 education professionals that have lost their jobs. I look at the larger class sizes, less offering for academic opportunities. This not the right direction in my view.
No, I agree. I mean, I think you're right. We start with certain natural attributes that make us, I think, would make us just prime for economic development, but you don't just park yourself on those attributes and say we're going to have a great future. You got to invest in it, and we simply haven't. And education, absolutely right. Education is one of the core things any society should invest in anywhere in the world, no matter if they have a good location or not. We haven't done it.
So what should we be doing? What would Governor Wolf do?
Governor Wolf would try to focus on a really, really strong education program. And I would include, we need to include the early childhood education as well as the K-12. I would invest in the great universities and sustain, help to support the great universities that exist in Pennsylvania. I would invest in the infrastructure. We need good highways. We need good bridges. I would look for other ways to move people and material around the state in a better way. I mean, when's the last time we looked at high-speed rail? Why is it the United States is lagging so far behind other nations in terms of high-speed rail? And all the places in the United States that should have high-speed rail should be Pennsylvania. There are a lot of things that we should be investing in. The last thing we should be doing is trying to figure out how we can cheapen what we're doing and find ways to take more money away from these investments. We need to invest in our future.
So let me ask you then, because, we keep hearing this call that we're broke. I keep hearing, well, we don't have any money. We can't make those investments. We can't invest in education or healthcare or high-speed rail, which I think we desperately need, more public transportation. What do you say to those people that, hey, we got this huge pension crisis, $42 billion we're going to have to pay tomorrow. It's the end of the world. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I mean, again, businesses go through cycles. There are times when businesses are less profitable than others. There are times when businesses actually lose money. But I don't know of any successful business successful over the long run that doesn't make investments throughout the cycle. So that means if you have to borrow the money as a business, I'm not talking about government, I'm talking about a business. If you want to borrow, if you have to borrow the money to make an investment that's going to make you stronger in the future, you do that. And I don't know where this idea came from that in government we follow the cycle religiously and actually withhold investments at, it turns out, the very time we actually need it most.
I'm right there with you. But, the reality is the messaging on this has been, and even some of my Democratic friends say, well, we just don't have the money. We can't make those investments. And I think you're right. I mean, we have to. But, you look at the numbers, and money's fairly cheap right now. I mean, we could make long-term investments that would, from a business perspective, that would pay off, no?
I think we can. And I think one of the things political leaders need to do is create some differentiation in the minds of the voters as to what you're investing in. I agree that in certain times, consumption you have to cut back. As families, we do that. But that doesn't mean that in these times you cut back on investments that are actually going to make you more productive. Businesses don't do that. Families don't cut back and say, okay, the economy's not doing so well. I don't have so many hours, so you're not going to go to college this year. We don't do that. And I think that's the way governments ought to act. It's the way, and I think, again, one of the challenges of leadership is to make sure we're doing that responsibly. But a governor needs to stand up and say, okay, here I understand we're going to cut back on consumption, but we're not going to cut back on the investments that are going to ensure our future. We've got to keep investing in those roads, those bridges, the educational system, all the other things that are going to continue to make us a great state. We don't cut back just because the economy's tanking.
Yeah, see, now, the way you lay that out, I agree with the idea of running government kind of like a business, that you invest in the future, you invest in what you're doing, instead of this idea that we need to slash, we need to cut, gut, and punish, because, well, we just don't have the money.
Yeah. I think you're referring, I think I said in my release that I'm not one that keeps going around and canting the phrase, we ought to run government like a business, because government isn't a business. Government has responsibilities that businesses simply don't have, to educate our youth, to build bridges, to provide the public goods that private businesses don't have to provide. So we are different, but there are some things and some parallels that I think we shouldn't lose sight of, and that is that when things are tough, businesses that want to be successful typically don't necessarily cut back. They certainly don't eliminate investments in really good capital goods, and the state should do this. Should not be any different in that regard.
I'm with you. Last question I've got for you, and back to the privatization of the lottery, some $3 million in consultant fees that are gone. I mean, that's money that could have gone to seniors. What should we be doing on those fronts? What should we be doing with the wine and spirit shops, with the lottery? What should we do?
Well, again, when I was Secretary of Revenue, the lottery was in the Revenue Department, so I guess I was in overall charge of it. And what I found was that there is not an organization in the world that can't be better. So let's start with that. I understand that, and continual improvement is the mantra of every organization in the world. So when I was there, everybody who working in the lottery was doing just that, trying to make the lottery better, and they succeeded. We did a number of things to raise revenues. We did a number of things to raise the profitability of the organization. And when I was there, and I think it's done better since I was there, I hope as a result of some of the things we did, that the lottery is throwing off about a 30% net profit margin. That's 30% as a percentage of sales. So $3 billion of sales, around $1 billion of net profit, give or take a few million. I don't know any business that wouldn't be satisfied with that. So I'm not sure where the dissatisfaction comes from. I'm not sure where the need to spend $3 million to make anything better is coming from, because it's a pretty good organization. Yeah. And it doesn't need to be privatized to be made even better. And I'm sure the same thing applies to the Liquor Control Board. Can it be made better? Absolutely. And it has been over successive administrations, Democratic and Republican. Can it be made better yet? I'm sure it can. And can it be made more convenient for the consumers of Pennsylvania? Sure. But privatization is not necessarily the way to do that. And I think it's just a mistake to focus on privatization as a goal in any situation, certainly not in this situation.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I heard, in speaking to some of the revenue employees, I heard it interesting, and maybe you can confirm it, that during your tenure as Secretary of Revenue, that you had met with each individual employee of the Revenue Department at some point during your tenure, just to talk about what it is they do and how that you can help to make it better.
Yeah, now that was a sign of weakness. I got to be Secretary of Revenue, and I realized I was not that knowledgeable about revenue. So I said, I really need to meet with the employees to figure out what actually goes on here. And when I said that to somebody, I think she told me, well, you can't do that. I said, well, why not? She said, well, there are 2,300 employees. And you just can't meet with them all. So I said, well, I need to do it anyway. So I did. It took me 13 months. But I met either singly or in small groups with employees, and really not just to say, you know, pat you on the back and say, hi, how are you? But I actually wanted to know, what do you do? What tools do you use? What tools would make your job easier, more efficient, better? And that really helped me to put together a plan for the department for new technology, new processes that actually was.
Step right up, folks, and take your chances in the amazing new American workplace. Constantly high unemployment, low wages always, no employee bargaining power, a corporate paradise. This paradise has enriched the already rich investor elite and rewarded top executives with multimillion-dollar pay packages. It also lets corporations treat the masses of people in today's workforce like Kleenexes. Just use them up and toss them. After all, they're cheap, plentiful, and disposable. Indeed, taskmasters in suits have now redefined the term hired to mean that you're tethered to a corporation full-time, but you actually work and get paid for only the few hours a week when the boss calls. This nefarious practice, known as on-call shifts, is all the rage among national retail chains. Such giants as Abercrombie & Fitch, Gap, and Urban Outfitters require employees to work without set schedules and to be available to have their string yanked at any time, day or night, even on weekends, with as little as 2 hours' notice. Likewise, if customer traffic in a store is slow, retail workers who got dressed up, battled the morning commute, and reported on time can simply be sent away after an hour or so, with no pay for their lost hours. A recent survey of some 400 retail employees in New York City found that only 17% have a set schedule. Those with no set hours also have no set income and no life. If you're at the beck and call of the boss, what do you do with your children? How do you make a doctor's appointment? What if you're taking a class or trying to work a second job? This is Jim Hightower saying, this shameful on-call practice says that the corporation owns you and that abuse of workers is a legitimate business practice in America. To help stop it, contact RetailActionProject.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
So the big news today was Bob Casey, our senator here from Pennsylvania, came out and said, you know what, the Defense of Marriage Act should be repealed. I didn't think he would, but he did. He said, look, you know, as a senator and as a citizen, he said, I can no longer in good conscience take a position that denies the full measure of equality and respect. He also went on to say that he believed that elected public officials have an obligation to refrain from demonizing and dividing people for partisan political gain. And I'm with him. I mean, personally, my thought on the issue is, you know, they should have the same rights as everyone else. We should all have the same rights. And as my grandfather always says, you know, don't worry about me. Worry about yourself. Just a thought, which is why I've asked Ted Martin. He's the executive director of Equality PA to come talk to us. Ted, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, not a problem. I'm happy to be on your show, Rick, anytime.
So I look at Bob Casey, and, you know, I got to be honest. I was kind of surprised by his recent position.
Well, I think that, you know, we've been talking with the senator for such a long time. We've been talking to him probably well over a year. We were responsible for bringing couples, you know, same-sex couples into his office. We had people email him. We had people introduce themselves. We had people talk to him personally. And then, you know, it all culminated in the past week with people phoning his office, and over 10,000 people did. So it certainly isn't for lack of, you know, introduction to the community. I mean, so many times legislators say, well, you know, we just don't hear from the community, or we just don't know the community. And in this case, I think Senator Casey actually got to know the community very much, and I think made the right decision. In fact, you know, you read his words. He actually stated that he had met people and he had heard from people. And so I think that helped. I mean, I think that absolutely positively helped. When you know people, when people come out around you, it's much harder to demonize them. It's much harder to think less of them. And I think really that's exactly what happened in this case.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the more recently Rob Portman, the senator from Ohio, who came out and, you know, kind of late, in my opinion, but, you know, came out in support as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I think the fact that Senator Portman came out, and I think to talk about what he talked about, it was a very personal thing. I mean, it was to his family, and it was someone that he cared about. And that's what's happening. That's really what's happening all over the country. And I think people are really coming to the conclusion that this is good for people. This is good for people care about. And so, you know, equality makes sense. And that's why this is happening. That's really why this is happening.
And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, why do we have to go through this whole exercise? I mean, you know, to me, there's this whole equal rights thing. You know, I should have the same right as you to do whatever it is that I want to do, as long as what I'm doing doesn't affect you and doesn't harm you in any way. I just don't see why this is an issue.
Well, I agree. I mean, I certainly agree. You know, as a gay man myself, I wonder why it's an issue. But I think the problem is that we're coming out of a long period of history when people didn't understand gay people, when they demonized gay people, when they said awful things about them. And let's face it, it hasn't been that long ago when an entire presidential election, really, you could argue, was won on demonizing gay people. And so, you know, when your leaders, when elected leaders, when people in medical professions talk about these things, it takes time. I mean, they have impact. People absolutely have impact. And so it just takes time to get past that. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, I think what is the big deal? Unfortunately, many people have told us incorrectly that it is a big deal, and that's why I think we have to work so much harder to get past all that. And the best way to do it is to be honest and authentic, and that's the way that minds are being changed.
Yeah, and the way you brought Senator Casey out on this issue, and rightly so in his case. But, you know, I look at this and I go, okay, you've got, what, 48 senators in the Senate? I think there are 7 Democrats left. Mark Pryor from Arkansas, guy from Indiana, I think Manchin from West Virginia, Nelson, Landrieu, Heidekamp, and Johnson are the last holdouts. Where is this going to go? I mean, let's say you get to the 50, let's say you get to 51, where does this lead us?
Well, I certainly hope it leads us to, you know, the Senate actually taking action on the Respect for Marriage Act, which is the act that would repeal DOMA. And I think absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, people need to understand where their elected officials are coming from. And I think if the Senate does support this, and if the House, as probably expected, says no, then people really need to clearly understand. I mean, the polls are way ahead. The public is way ahead of elected officials. And so, you know, if people are forced to have a recorded vote, if people are forced to show where they stand, that helps people move even further. That helps the American people formulate even stronger views because they see where people truly stand. And no one has had to vote on these things for quite a long time. And so that's where we need to be. And that's, you know, why we've successfully been able to sort of drag out the hatred, drag out all this negative stuff for so long because, you know, people haven't had to go on record. And so, you know, my hope is that they're going to be forced to be on record because, you know, the thing about the Supreme Court arguments last week, or really the thing about the Supreme Court arguments last week, is that, you know, people were able to see that all of those negative arguments about the destruction of society and all those negative, you know, arguments were really put on trial too, and most of them were found to be pretty hollow.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that's where this is going. I think that's where this is going.
Yeah, well, I hope so, because, you know, I've always been of the mindset, you know, the adoption issue. You know, I would rather have a child being raised by two people who actually love the kid and care for it and do it and give it the opportunities that the kid needs instead of, you know, some of the parents that I see who are, you know, they're fighting and they're bickering and there's a lot of dissension, a lot of problems. I don't think it matters. I think if you have people who are going to help and push and do the right thing, why should it matter?
Well, I think, you know, I think that once again, it's exactly right. You know, for a long time, for many, many years, people never saw gay people. And now I think that most people are just seeing the lives of gay people, you know, that are just like everybody's, you know, that they're just, there's nothing exotic or dramatic or strange. They suffer the same, joys and sorrows and ups and downs that everyone faces. And so that makes it much more human. That makes it much more real.
Yeah, because here's where I'm at with this. And look, the reason I think this is something that we need to be talking about is as soon as we can get this behind us and say, you know what, under the law, we're all equal and we should all have the same rights and all of that, then we can move on to the things that I think are important, like, oh, I don't know, an economy that makes sure that workers have the ability to feed their families. I don't know, maybe health care for everyone. Some issues that I think are important.
Well, I think, you know, you're exactly right. In a lot of ways, these issues have been used to
and I don't want to, Ted, I don't want to diminish this issue in your eyes, and I don't want people to think that, you know, I think it's less, but what I think is important, is a little bit different than I'm sure what you think are important in this arena. I'd like this to be behind us so that we can create jobs, we can rebuild infrastructure, we can get education to all the kids. There's so many things we should be talking about I don't think we are.
Well, and the thing is, you know, LGBT people are all part of that equation too. You know, they want great jobs. They need, you know, better infrastructure, better education. I mean, all of those things are important. And you're right. I mean, it holds us back from really talking about issues that matter to people. And the LGBT community is part of those that, you know, amorphous group of people that are being impacted. So that's all incredibly correct.
Yeah, because I don't want to sound like I'm diminishing this at all, because I understand it's extremely important to your community, and for me it's important in that we're all equal. I mean, I don't really have a stake in the game, but I think I think if, you know, like Rob Portman, you know, his son's gay, now he wants to have equality for his kids. What happens if that's right? My kids go. I want to make sure that it's, that everyone has the same platform.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
All right. I just want to make sure, because I don't want to diminish the issue. And I, for a second there, it sounded like maybe I was, but I'm not.
No, I didn't take it that way. You're okay.
So let me ask you this, because there are some who think that, you know, that this isn't an issue. And I look at this woman, the Sue Everhart. She's the chairwoman of the Republican Party there in Georgia, who said, and I'll read her quote directly that was in the Marietta Daily Journal on Saturday. She said, you may be as straight as an arrow, and you may find a friend that is as straight as an arrow. Say you have a great job with the government where you have this wonderful health plan. She says, I mean, what would prohibit you from saying that you're gay and you all get married and still live as separate, but you get all the benefits? She said, I just see so much abuse in this, it's unreal. She said, I believe a husband and a wife should be a man and a woman. The benefits should be for a man and a woman. There is no way about that this should be equality. She said, to me, it's about a free ride. So how do you address that free ride argument?
Well, how do you address it? You address it simply as this. Then obviously there must be rampant abuse, because, you know, if it's that easy and if there's so many jobs out there with such great benefits and so many people are just rushing, then maybe they should, you know, look at the people who are currently allowed to have those benefits and see whether or not that abuse actually exists. I mean, where does that abuse actually exist?
Because I saw it on TV. I saw it at the movies. I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry. I saw it. It was right there on the big screen.
Well, I still think, you know, people need to, you know, understand that it just doesn't happen. This is just hard. You know, you can't put your finger on this, and she can't say that either. And, you know, and obviously I think this is just one more dodge. This is one more simple dodge. And there have to be rules that prohibit this kind of stuff, and there have to be rules that are obeyed. And if they're not being obeyed now, then, you know, maybe they need to address that issue before we move on to anything else.
I think it's probably one of the dumbest things I've ever heard anyone say, to be honest, because, you know, the question, if that is your concern, that people are going to, that, you know, two straight people are going to get married, because they want health care benefits, doesn't that say something about our health care system and maybe the need to make sure that all of us have access to decent health care or whatever the benefit is that she's so afraid people are going to get?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think if people are willing to go to that much extreme for simple basic coverage that everyone should be afforded anyways in the United States, or people have to take that big of a leap, and even in the movie that you cited, I mean, it was an extreme situation. Then there's far worse problems. There's far more serious problems in our society that need to be dealt with than the fact that, you know, this alleged, you know, takeover of the benefit system by, you know, same-sex couples is going to happen. I mean, trust me, there are more underlying problems than she's willing to address.
But here again, to me, it's more of this divide and conquer. And over the weekend, you know, to kind of put this into the civil rights perspective, I happened to sit down, and I had never seen Norma Rae. You know, I'd read about it. I'd never seen the movie. And in the movie, they had a moment where the employer had posted a notice to all the white employees that, you know, eventually the colors, they're going to take over and they're going to run you. And to me, this is in that same vein, that divisive tactic to divide us and to really scare the hell out of people.
You're exactly right. I mean, I think fear is such an important part of all this, and fear is such a driving force. And that's why, you know, politically this issue has been used so effectively, because people didn't know. People simply didn't know and didn't know gay people or didn't know gay relationships or didn't know these things. And so as people have come out, as people have become more visible, these issues just become more phony. They become more hollow. They become more ridiculous. And that's the value. I mean, that's why the world is changing. That's absolutely why the world is changing, because people are talking about these things.
Yeah, it's out in the public, and you can, you know, and I've often said, you know, maybe when it gets to the point where you say something about somebody and they smack you, maybe it ends. Because I think about my grandparents' generation, and my grandfather always had a saying, you know, sometimes you just need to make a citizen out of somebody and give them a good crack across the back of the head. And maybe if we return to the days where, you know, you said something stupid and someone cracked you, maybe you wouldn't do it again.
Well, you know, the thing is, I always, you know, when you're a position like I am, when you're a gay person in many instances, I think you have to have a pretty thick skin. Because what I've noticed is that people ask you some of the most ridiculous questions you'd ever want to know. And most people don't do it out of malice, but you have to be prepared for them. I think you have to be prepared for them. I think you have to be prepared to react to them. And, you know, your grandmother was right. I think you have to be able to say, well, maybe not smack them as much as I'd probably like to crack the Georgia person up again. You know, I think that, you know, you have to be really ready to talk about them. And that's what they're not expecting. And that's what they don't want. And that's why, you know, the value of conversation and being honest is so important.
Yeah, I mean, because the truth of the matter is, I think as you've pointed out, you know, most people, they don't know. And I wonder how many of those questions are out of malice and hatred, or any of them are just out of ignorance.
Well, it's exactly right. You know, and I think we need to point out the obvious. You know, when couples started getting married in New York over a year ago, reporters called me, you know, what was going to happen? What was going to happen? And, you know, and I really said that, you know, nothing was going to happen in Pennsylvania, but Pennsylvanians would have a front row seat to see that the world would continue the day after marriage became legal, that people would get married, they would go to work, they would live their lives, the foundations of society wouldn't crumble. And that's what's happening. That's absolutely what's happening. People are seeing the fact that this doesn't impact anyone negatively. Getting, you know, two men or two women getting married does not negatively, you know, impact society. And as I've often said, if the fact that I'm married to a man negatively impacts your marriage, you've got a lot bigger problems in it than you think you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I think that's really the essence of this.
Absolutely. So what should we be doing to help push this along? I mean, I don't see really much hope in the House, but maybe if you get something in the Senate, what should we be doing?
Well, I think, you know, what we should be doing is continuing to talk about these issues, one. But I think we should have a larger realization. The one thing I really hope people take away from Senator Casey is that they take a real look at Pennsylvania when it comes to LGBT issues, for example. If we're just talking directly to Pennsylvanians, Pennsylvania does a really terrible job protecting LGBT citizens. So not only can we not marry, but we can be fired from our job. There are no hate crimes protections. There are no protections from being evicted. So I think people need to start really using this opportunity, obviously, to talk about marriage equality, but to really look at the full picture of how we treat LGBT people everywhere, to realize that we've done some pretty awful things to them in the past, and it's really time now to think about how we make all of that better.
I'm right there with you. Ted, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you, and I appreciate the fact that you come back whenever we ask.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rick. Not a problem.
Ted Martin, Executive Director of Equality Pennsylvania, equalitypa.org, the website. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
This is why we fight, why we
for the rest of us, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
1,000 Las Vegas taxi drivers represented by IPTEU OPEIU Local 4873 remain on strike as tensions rise on the picket lines. The union says a driver that crossed picket lines recently assaulted a striking driver at the Yellow Checker Star Transportation Headquarters in Las Vegas and was issued a citation for battery. IPTEU 4873 President Dennis Arrington called on the company to take control of any drivers who cross the picket lines and make sure this kind of behavior stops immediately. Sam Moffat is chief union steward for the drivers at Local 4873. He says the union is ready to bargain a fair solution to the strike, but the company is trying to impose its own terms.
The company declared shortly after we rejected their last proposal, 70% of our membership rejected their proposal. The company then implemented their final proposal and declared that we were at an impasse and they were not discussing any more to do with the contract.
Activists in 10 states handed out Don't Do Coke flyers at supermarkets to highlight what they say are the negative impacts the billionaire Koch brothers are having on American democracy. It was part of the Big Apple Coffee Party's Don't Do Coke campaign. The campaign is suggesting alternatives to products made by Coke companies. The United Auto Workers Union has been steadily adding members since 2009. The union's active membership in 2012 stood at 382,513. In 2009, the UAW had 355,191 members. The union says these Labor Department numbers actually don't reflect the true total number of workers represented by the UAW, because workers who have organized but don't yet have their first contracts aren't counted. Academic workers in the UAW who have not yet signed membership cards are also not yet counted. When those workers are counted, the UAW says its active membership is more than 400,000. A sanitation strike in Ohio is growing as more Teamsters honor picket lines. Jesse Russell reports.
A garbage strike in Elyria, Ohio, expanded on Monday with additional Teamsters honoring the picket line of Local 377. The sanitation workers are striking Republic Services Allied Waste in Ohio, protesting alleged violations of federal labor laws. Since the strike started, Republic workers in other cities, including Evansville, Indiana, and Urbana, Illinois, have stopped work in solidarity. The workers allege that Republic has refused to provide information related to bargaining and has changed working conditions without negotiations. Republic has said negotiations are stalled over an offer to switch workers from a pension fund to a 401k. 2012 was a volatile year for the company and the workers. In early 2012, sanitation workers in Mobile, Alabama, went out on strike, alleging that the company refused to honor their contract. Later that year, Evansville, Indiana, saw a six-week-long work stoppage when Republic locked out workers.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. So the big story today, and well, another one, Governor Corbett's privatization scheme. You know, we need to sell off the lottery, let a foreign corporation take it over, you know, because it's run so poorly. Experts say one of the best in the country. Even Camelot Global said an example of how it should be done, one of the best in the country. But we need to do it worse, because if you look at what they proposed, they would have done it worse. Anyway, consultant fees, almost $3 million Corbett has spent scheming off our lottery. Where's that money coming from? Well, it's either going to come from you, the taxpayer, or it's going to come from Granny. And the Patriot did an interesting little mock-up of what almost $3 million would buy, would help almost 140,000 prescriptions be purchased for seniors. Over 1 million free transportation rides for seniors to and from doctor's visits or, you know, to get whatever they need. Over 6,000 rebates for seniors through state property tax and rent rebates. And 576 months of nursing home care. We just gave that away to consultants. That should anger and frustrate and tick off every person in this state, and remember that come next election time. I've got our good friend on the line, Abe Amoros. He's legislative director for the Laborers International Union here in Pennsylvania. Abe, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, you're welcome, Rick.
So
pleasure to be with you.
Almost $3 million just given away.
That's unbelievable, Rick. I am outraged by that because it comes at the expense of services to people who need it and also at the expense of taxpayers. And when you're talking about privatization, what you really ought to be looking at, if I were Tom Corbett, is efficiency. And when you're actually throwing away $3 million on something that is not substantive, that raises all kinds of concerns and red flags.
Yeah.
Prescriptions, services to seniors, that should be top priority to this administration, not millions of dollars for consultants. And you know that many of those consultants are friends of the administration. You know that some of them are contributors to the administration. So the whole thing just stinks to high heaven.
Yeah, another example of patronage.
Exactly.
You know, but I look at this and I go, you know, that's something we could be spending better. We should be spending better, but we're not. And, you know, at the end of this, you know, the whole lottery thing to me just blows my mind that this is how we fund programs for seniors. To me, it should be something that we have hard-lined in the budget, not vice spending, but, you know, it's where we are.
That's right. And it is self-sustaining, Rick. I mean, the lottery is one of the most efficient programs in the country. The Pennsylvania Lottery does a fine job on its own as part of the state government. It does not need to be privatized. And these promises of billions of dollars at the end of the rainbow, unproven, untested, and in my opinion, pie in the sky. I just don't understand why we would take the risk of privatizing the lottery and really putting seniors and services at risk and peril. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And he's doing this for political gain, Rick, simply because he needs some sort of victory going into next year's election. And when you have so many people lining up against him and the polls sagging, he has to try all kinds of crazy things. And then these things come out in the wash simply because they're wrong. I mean, privatizing the lottery is just a bad move overall. And then handing out millions of dollars to your friends and consulting fees is even worse.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, a little earlier in the program, we spoke with former Revenue Secretary Tom Wolf about today. He said, you know what, he's in. He sent out an email to his supporters, he's in. And good, because I think now we have a progressive choice of the people who are out there. And I think it's a good thing. I think it will help push some of the issues where I think is in the right direction.
I agree with you. I've had the privilege of knowing Tom Wolf for more than 20 years. He's a responsible, philanthropic businessman who's also incredibly bright and, in my opinion, would put the workers ahead of special interests. I know that Tom has $10 million set aside on his own, and God bless him for that because he's going to need every penny of it. But I do believe that we are going to have a very substantive, progressive voice, someone who can come to the table, who is going to be prepared, who has experience in state government, has experience running a very successful business, and in my opinion is also going to draw a lot of Republican support. So I'm pulling for Tom, and I hope he does very well.
Yeah, you know, I asked him point blank. I said, you know, as a business, as somebody who runs a business, and hearing this frame of we need to run government like a business, to which he said, you know, government is not a business. But if you want to draw parallels, you know, investing in infrastructure is something we should be doing. And I put it out to him. I said, you know, our governor back in his State of the State address said, you know what, you're going to put $1.8 billion into infrastructure spending on a need that even his commission said was $6.5 billion. And Tom said, quite frankly, it's not nearly enough.
It's not nearly enough. And here we are on April the 2nd, Rick, and still nothing in place in terms of a strategic, comprehensive transportation plan. This can't go on much longer. I'm just astonished that this administration and this legislature have conveniently passed over transportation funding. The first thing they're going to talk about is what is the Senate going to do in terms of privatizing the state store system, which is another horrible idea,
boondoggle,
in my opinion. And then they're going to attack a public employees' pensions. And then they're going to leave transportation to the end. And my concern, Rick, is that the construction season is going to pass us over. These things should have been in place already in terms of bids, in terms of projects that are being specified. Legislators should have been brought in at the very beginning, brought to the table so they could deliberate and discuss priorities back in their districts. But yet this administration has chosen to go off the deep end and do crazy things for political expedience. And so, you know, getting back to Tom Wolf, I do hope that he has a very progressive strategic platform that will put Pennsylvanians back to work and will reprioritize our needs in terms of that much-needed infrastructure. And again, Rick, I know I say this a lot on your program, but I really don't want to see what happened in Minnesota happen in Pennsylvania.
Hold on,
I don't
want
to see anyone's life in peril.
I'm with you. You know, and being in Harrisburg, where that's been one of the sinkhole capitals of the world, 41 sinkholes in the last year. You know, we've got some serious problems to be addressed. And there's part of me that looks at this, Abe, and as I understand, there's not even a transportation bill to be looked at. Am I right?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. None has been brought to the public yet. I know that Senator John Rafferty from the Southeast, a progressive Republican, a moderate Republican, is in the wings waiting to push out a bill, and hopefully we'll see that in April. I had the fortune of sitting down with him, talking about this plan, and I do believe that it's going to have quite a bit of support in the Senate. But the trick is in the House, Rick. This is one of the least efficient Republican houses I have ever seen in my 20, 25 years of experience in the Capitol. They're inept. They're incompetent. They're short-sighted, and it's just, I don't know. I'm at a loss for words. Fortunately, we do have a good group of labor-friendly Republicans in the Southeast who have voted to stop bad legislation from taking place in terms of harming us, in terms of stopping prevailing wage, and in terms of pushing right-to-work legislation, which is a really bad idea. So we're fortunate in that respect. But the ballgame is really in the House of Representatives, and the leadership there has just been awful.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up incompetent and inept. And, you know, that, to me, is conservative leadership. That's Republican leadership right now. And it really, as I've been saying, you know, it's by design. They have this frame of government doesn't work, and then they set out to prove that.
That's exactly right. What they want to do is starve government. They don't want to put the necessary resources in rebuilding our infrastructure, in taking care of the citizenry, in creating job opportunities, and really protecting our seniors either. What they want to do is they want to have these little victories for political season next year. They want to privatize, cut pensions, cut wages from workers' paychecks, and it's absolutely wrong. We cannot afford four more years of this inept leadership in the House or at in the governor's residence. It's this is the time to become outraged. This is the time for us to really step it up and hold our leaders accountable.
I'm with you. But let me ask you this, Ed, because there's part of me that thinks this, all of this stall and all of this delay and all of the shiny things that keep us divided and pitted against one another over is something that they're planning to roll out next year. And I'm talking about the transportation infrastructure spending. You know, if you don't spend it this year, do they double up on it next year so it has a bigger impact? And hopefully, they think hopefully we'll have amnesia and forget that they've done nothing for the previous 3 years. And once people start getting back to work and you start seeing things getting done, that they go, oh, well, see, things are getting done. We should keep these bums around.
Yes, it would not surprise me, Rick, if they have employed that strategy and are ready to pull the trigger on it next year. It wouldn't surprise me one bit. This is a sneaky group of guys and gals up there who really have their own personal interests at heart rather than the taxpayers, rather than the workers and the citizens of the state. Wouldn't surprise me in the least if they intentionally kicked this down the road, pushed it down the alley, so to speak, until 2014, knowing that it's an election year. So it's incumbent upon us to hold their feet to the fire, to squawk on a daily basis and say, we need this now. We don't need this in 2014. And then it is also our responsibility to call them on it next year and say, you know, this is nothing more than a ruse. When you had the opportunity to do it, you didn't, and now the cost is going to go up. The price tag is going to increase simply because you didn't act in a timely fashion. So all of these things are going to snowball, and they're not. It's not a good snowball effect. We need investments now. We need things fixed today, and it's just common sense. But yet these Republicans, they are politically sneaky people. And what they want us to do is forget about it in 2013 so they can come back stronger, bigger, better, et cetera, in 2014 and hoodwink us once again. And I'm really hoping that we have a very good field of Democratic opponents who are going to be a tremendous, what I want to say is that they're going to be a tremendous alternative to what we have in place right now, because I have a hard time even articulating the kind of leadership or lack thereof that Tom Corbett has provided for us in this state.
You know, and for me, you know, I look at this, and, you know, infrastructure spending used to be one of those things everybody agreed on. Yeah, it was good for workers. It was good for businesses because you need to get to work. You need to get your products to the, you know, to the market. It used to be a no-brainer. It was just done.
That's exactly right, Rick. It was one of those things that everybody could agree upon simply because it makes good economic sense. It is devoid of any ideological arguments. If something needs fixed, let's fix it now. Save the money before it gets worse. That's not a Democratic ideal. It's not a Republican ideal. It's a common sense ideal. Yet there is such acrimony in the Capitol right now and disagreement that you can't get anything accomplished. I mean, that is the worst example of gridlock that I have seen in the state capitol in many, many years.
You know what we did get accomplished, though, Abe? We spent almost $3 million privatizing, trying to privatize something that didn't need to be privatized,
yes.
And we've enriched some consultants.
That's right, and it wouldn't surprise me, Rick, if some of those consultants didn't hang their hats in the state of Pennsylvania, which would be even worse. So here we are helping our friends who live out of state pad their pockets and enrich their kids' college funds when he ought to be worrying about the college funds of the workers in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, 2014 can't come quick enough, and his ouster can't come quick enough for me.
Yes, sir.
Abe, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate your insight.
Thank you very much, Rick. Good to be with you.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Abe Amoros, legislative director for Pennsylvania for the Laborers International Union. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
I know many of you are going to be interested in this next subject. Pennsylvania sits within a day's drive of 60% of the nation's population. Every year, nearly $500 billion worth of goods and services move through our state transportation system. Transportation is the bloodstream of our economy. If it fails, our economy fails. However, as you know, the average bridge in our state is 51 years old.
I sure hope not. I hope it doesn't come to that. I think, like Abe said, you don't want to see what happened in Minnesota happen here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, you look at all of the sinkholes, you look at, you know, the fact that we haven't invested in infrastructure in several years and haven't adequately invested in our infrastructure in well, probably at least a generation. And you go, at some point, Corbyn himself says, well, you know, we're going to get her overnight, so we're going to do nothing. And you look at the fact that he's proposed $1.8 billion in spending on a need that his own commission says $6.5 billion. That's just too functional. That's not even investing in future technology and expanding. That's just being functional. And I look at this and I go, you know, at some point, don't you think that there would be some political price to pay for all of this inaction? And I understand, you know, you look at Corbett's approval numbers in the tank, but don't you think these senators, don't you think these representatives at some point have to go, you know what, I've got to at least do my job so that something gets done, something's functional, so that people don't say throw all the bums out? Wouldn't you think? And I guess it goes back to that whole mentality that, well, you know, they're all bums except, you know, my guy's okay. And I've heard that an awful lot. Well, you know, my representative's a good one. He's one of the good ones. It's the rest of them that stink. Look, all of them. Got to get something done. Because failure, as Corbett pointed out, failure would bring the whole state down. Within a day's drive of 60% of the population, we've got opportunity that, well, he's not willing to pursue. What they are willing to pursue, though, austerity, pain, cuts, more job losses. We've fallen to 46th in the nation in job creation. From the people who told us it was all going to be jobs, 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 laser-like focus. And we're seeing real time what happens when that mentality is pursued. We're seeing it played out in real time in the Eurozone. Those 17 nations that make up the Eurozone, their unemployment rates have reached record highs. And why? Well, because they're canning people, cutting, because, you know, austerity is going to be good for us, because it's going to bring down our debt. Yet you look at it, and the debt hasn't really come down. The deficits haven't come down. In fact, the jobless rate reached 12% in both January and February, the highest rate since the creation of the euro. For the EU overall, the jobless rate hit 10.9% in January, rose up to 12% from 10.9% in January of this year. 26 million people in the Eurozone unemployed. 26 million people. They are on the edge of a triple dip recession. And I ask, okay, you know, I get the argument. I get the argument, well, you know, we're broke and we don't want to end up like Greece or any of the, you know, those countries who have outrageous debt. I mean, we don't, but I get the fear tactic. But I also understand, as Tom Wolf pointed out earlier, there's no business that will survive that doesn't invest. You know, if you show me any business, if you're not upgrading your equipment, if you're not buying new computers and staying up with technology, you're falling behind. You're failing. And what's happened is we've got these Republicans who have taken over our state government and really our national government. They've hijacked the whole thing and nothing happens. So if we do nothing today, what happens? Well, the rest of the world keeps evolving. Things keep moving forward. Except us. And I go back to the woman who worked over at Treasury who said, you know, we wanted to do a webinar. And the person that, you know, facilitates this stuff said we couldn't possibly do it with our computer system because our computer systems are so badly outdated because the state won't invest in upgrades. And you go, is that how you'd run a business? Well, it is how the right wing would run a business into the ground. And I go back to the whole thing with Peabody. You know, they've basically set up a subsidiary, our federal government and our state governments, and they're designing them to fail so that the privateers, so that they can take over. This is all coming, folks. Understand, this is the game plan. This is their MO. They're going to push us down that path, the path towards bankruptcy. so that they can wipe away all of that pension security, all of that health care, all of that stuff, and they can create the desperation class that is going to make them and their ilk so incredibly, incredibly wealthy. All at your expense and mine. Something wrong there. Anyway, if you want to contact me, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone to take the program on the go. Quick break, back with Hour 3. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Step right up, folks, and take your chances in the amazing new American workplace. Constantly high unemployment, low wages always, no employee bargaining power, a corporate paradise. This paradise has enriched the already rich investor elite and rewarded top executives with multimillion-dollar pay packages. It also lets corporations treat the masses of people in today's workforce like Kleenexes. Just use them up and toss them. After all, they're cheap, plentiful, and disposable. Indeed, taskmasters in suits have now redefined the term hired to mean that you're tethered to a corporation full-time, but you actually work and get paid for only the few hours a week when the boss calls. This nefarious practice, known as on-call shifts, is all the rage among national retail chains. Such giants as Abercrombie and Fitch, Gap, and Urban Outfitters require employees to work without set schedules and to be available to have their string yanked at any time, day or night, even on weekends, with as little as 2 hours' notice. Likewise, if customer traffic in a store is slow, retail workers who got dressed up, battled the morning commute, and reported on time can simply be sent away after an hour or so, with no pay for their lost hours. A recent survey of some 400 retail employees in New York City found that only 17% have a set schedule. Those with no set hours also have no set income and no life. If you're at the beck and call of the boss, what do you do with your children? How do you make a doctor's appointment? What if you're taking a class or trying to work a second job? This is Jim Hightower saying, this shameful on-call practice says that the corporation owns you and that abuse of workers is a legitimate business practice in America. To help stop it, contact RetailActionProject.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind. You can also email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So yesterday, an interesting idea and something I'm a big fan of. I like the idea of carrots. So this group in South Carolina decided that, well, you know, this restaurant, this Copper River Grill has been harassing and coercing and I guess basically surveillance and interrogation and discrimination, you name it, against their employees who said, you know what, we kind of like to have a voice on the job, you know, maybe a decent living. They organized a dine-in where about 50 people in the community said, you know what, we support the workers, we're going to come, we're going to support the restaurant and support the workers. And I think that's such a great idea, which is why I've asked Russell Bannon. He's the chair of the South Carolina Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee. He helped organize the dine-in event there at the Copper River Grill. Russell, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Matt.
So I look at this and I go, you know, this is the things that we should be doing more of, getting community involvement, showing workers that, you know what, there are people around town who care that they have a decent wage, who care that they can make it on their own and don't have to ask for assistance from government to make their way.
Oh, that's exactly right. And I mean, what we saw was within 2 days of actually putting the event out there, that overwhelming people came out and flooded into the place. So, you know, over 50, we're counting actually even more as time has continued to go by. We're probably looking around 75, getting close to 100 probably by the end of today.
So in looking at this situation, what drove you to it? I mean, you know, I talked about a second ago that, you know, I guess there have been a dozen charges of unfair.
Well, I was born and raised actually in this town in Spartanburg. And these guys reached out to me because they didn't know anyone in labor, and that's, you know, very common in the South, and they didn't know what to do, what was the process, what is a union. And, you know, that was about a year ago. And then I get a call from them last week and said, hey, we're having an election, but can you guys get the community together to support us? And I asked what was going on. And when they began, like, running through the charges, talking about the harassment, to the point of where one of the women who was fired actually had her house spray-painted, the words, you know, I don't know if I can say this on the air, but union bitch on her mailbox.
Wow.
And trash was dumped into her yard. I mean, it's beyond what you know, it sounds like the 1920s.
That's insane to me.
And that's what that's what drove me in, is like, oh, wow, we have to do something.
And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, is it that big of a deal that people have access to say, you know what, I'd like to make a decent wage, I'd like to be able to support my family? And I look at one of the quotes in the article that I read on this, that the woman asked, you know, is it too much that I, as a working mother, can put food on my table without asking for food stamps? Is that too much to ask? And I don't think it is.
And I would say the community clearly agrees. That's why they came out in the number, you know, in these numbers, because that is not too much to ask. If you work a full-time job, you should be able to take care of yourself and your kids.
Yeah, and you know, I look at this, and there's part of me that says, you know, part of me that says we need to be engaging people. You know, a lot of what I see when you talk about organizing campaigns, or, you know, they try to isolate the workers, and you get unions who don't want to talk to the general public. And I keep saying, you know, at the end of this, it's about all of us, not just those handful of workers, but about all workers.
And that's the truth. And Copper River, and its owners and its managers, made these workers think they're all out there on their own. And what we've said is, while you're not, we're with you. Number one, a lot of us grew up, you know, went to high school together. We know each other's families. And so to hear these things that are happening, it's just heartbreaking. And Copper River is saying that, you know, when they pay hardworking employees starvation wages, that, you know, we actually think that the government shouldn't be subsidizing our workforce.
Yeah, but I look at this, and you hit on something there that, you know, for 30 years we've been hearing you're an individual, you can make your own deal, you know, trying to divide us and keep us separated from joining a community. As you've said, you know, you went to high school together, you live in the same neighborhoods. You know, the wealth class of this country has done everything they can do to slice us and dice us and pit us against each other so that we don't stand together and say, you know what?
Exactly.
We'd like a little bit of the wealth that we create.
And that's exactly what these workers, and, you know, I have to say, it's extremely inspiring to see that on their own they began organizing and forming this independent union outside of any support from the nationals or locals or anything. Just began organizing and putting everything on the line to the point where three of them have been fired for their participation in union activity.
And what's going to happen with them?
There's unfair labor practice charges that we are extremely confident are going to win. Two of the people who were fired, the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, ruled, will be able to participate in the election on Thursday and Friday. So that's a, you know, extremely good sign. I mean, the employer is clearly wrong. Whether it gets recognized by the NLRB or not is irrelevant. We're going to rally and we're going to fight for these people in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and Bowling Springs, South Carolina.
And it's just not there. I mean, this fight should be across the country. We should be doing these things in workplaces across the country. And it's, you know, the reason it caught my attention is we're talking about South Carolina.
Yes. Where unions don't exist is what they try to tell us.
And for me, you know, if in South Carolina you have these kind of people, you have people who are saying, you know, enough is enough already. I think the rest of the country time to wake up and realize enough is enough. I mean, we see stories every day about, you know, the CEOs and the very wealthy at the very top doing wildly well. Never better. Corporate profits never higher. Wall Street, fat and happy. CEOs pay through the roof. And yet here we got people who are working their butts off. Can't even afford to put food on the table. And, like, yesterday I was in Charleston, West Virginia for the mine workers event, where they're trying to steal the health care from the retirees by some gimmick that they set up this shell corporation to basically go bankrupt and screw these people. And I keep going, you know, when's the epiphany? When's that moment of clarity where folks are going to say enough already?
And I mean, I think that's exactly right. There's an epidemic in this country of low wage, starvation wage jobs. And what we're seeing time and time again now is workers have just had enough. Doesn't matter if they're in South Carolina, in Charleston, Virginia, or wherever. Like, people are sick and tired of this.
So let me ask you, Russell, you know, I look at this, and I like the idea of the dine-in. I like the carrot idea. But what do you say to somebody who goes, you know, this is an employer, this Copper River Grill, who's accused of harassing their employees and coercion and surveillance and all of these things. You know, why would we reward them by bringing 50 or 75 or, as you pointed out, upwards of 100 people into their restaurant to reward them for these bad acts?
Well, I think the point to be made there is, like, right now before the election, we want to show the people that work there that, you know, we are coming in to show our support for them. And that was part of the, you know, the actual conversation that I had. You know, we sat down, we had a conversation with our person that was serving us. You know, we had a conversation with the hostess. We had a conversation with the bartender, just letting them know, you know, what we think you guys is doing is inspiring. And we're very proud to see that you guys have the courage to stand up here in South Carolina, where it's not easy to do so.
Yeah.
And to get rid of that fear that the employer's pushing on.
Yeah, because I look at, you know, most of my life we've talked about, you know, back in the Reagan years, they talked about moving away from a manufacturing-based economy to a service-based economy. And I've been saying for the longest time, fine, okay, we got rid of our manufacturing. China's the world's largest manufacturer, and we gave that away. What's the next generation of middle-class jobs? What's the next generation of jobs like the factory and the mines and the truck-driving jobs of yesteryear? What's that next generation of jobs that's going to be able to support a family and be able to put their kids through college and do what past generations have done? And these service sector jobs, the ones we have to be that.
Right. And companies like Copper River are making bank, where Victoria, the woman who was quoted in the piece, you know, she was telling me her story. And when she goes into work, you know, she serves a certain amount, and sometimes she leaves with less money. And when she went in, because of the policy they have, you have to tip out on the amount of products in which you've sold. So whether or not you make that much back in tips, you still have to pay it out. So she left with $20 less in her pocket than when she went to work.
How's that possible?
I don't know. I would say it's illegal. And if it's not, then it should be. But it's an outrage to the point where actually a state representative who was sitting with me heard this story, State Representative Harold Mitchell in South Carolina. I mean, he pledged to introduce legislation to protect these often exploited service workers. And, you know, he said it's against federal law to fire someone for organizing for better pay or working conditions, but we need to require bosses to have a just cause to take someone's livelihood away from them.
Yes.
So that when Victoria is standing up to actually fight back, she can't be fired without reason. And right now in Right to Work states, you can be fired because you're at will.
Well, that's not just Right to Work states. That's Pennsylvania as well. If you don't have a union contract, if you don't have a written contract, you're at will. You come to work tomorrow and say, there's no reason. You're just gone. So, you know, in talking about a lot of things, you know, I spoke earlier with someone about paid sick days, and she said, well, you know, if you can't be fired in New York under this proposed legislation, if you take a sick day, I go, yeah, but you can be fired for everything else.
And imagine the world, though, where we could organize for different sick days or whatever at work without fear of being fired, because now it is law that we can only be fired for just cause.
Yep.
Imagine how much easier it would be to organize.
And I keep saying, you know, to me, that at-will component, that part that you've highlighted there, to me, that's one of the main reasons I think people should be organizing into unions, whether it be a locally based association of, hey, just our little workforce, we're going to go it alone, or if you become, you know, a member of one of the big labor organizations. To me, having that contract, having that written document enforceable by law, because we, Right now, we sort of kind of still believe in the rule of law, although that seems to be changing, especially when you talk about workers. But that should be the draw of people to say, you know what, we want to collectively bargain. We want to have that piece of paper that every CEO in the country has.
And what's really inspiring about what's happening in South Carolina here is labor isn't worried about, oh, they're not affiliated with the AFL-CIO or change to when or this, that, the other. The idea is, oh, wow, there's workers fighting back for respect and dignity in the job. What can we do to help out?
Yeah, I mean, we're still trying to figure out what the new face of labor is going to be, what the new organizing is going to be. And I think just getting people together, bringing communities back together, because there's been so much resource and so many politicians and so much messaging around, you're an individual. You don't need to be part of the group. You can make your own deal.
Right.
We've got a lot of work to bring people, the neighbors, to talking to each other.
No, and that's exactly right. And what's actually really cool is all these different community groups now in Spartanburg and Bowling Springs are organizing actions at Copper River to show their support and doing sticker stuff.
Good
about this. They saw what happened. They were inspired. They said, how can we help? And so they're doing like a women's dine-in night, just like build a place full of these different women to show, hey, look, we're behind you as well.
Yep.
And the Democratic Party is doing this. And, you know, you name this, that, and the other church is doing this. And so that's what's really inspiring to me is that this isn't just a labor issue. It's our community issue.
Yep. And, you know, as I say, you know, you change the world one community at a time. Because when in Spartanburg, South Carolina, when they decide, you know what, we're going to change our little corner of the world, well, you know what, maybe here in Harrisburg we change our little corner of the world as well.
And if we can do it in South Carolina, the heartbeat of right to work and neoconservative laws, and you can do it anywhere.
Yep. Russell, I appreciate the time. Keep up the great work, and I'd love to hear more as this goes on. I'd love to hear what the election results turn out to be.
Can I have one thing to ask your listeners to do?
Absolutely.
I would ask that people call Copper River Grill and talk to the hostess and just say your name, where you're from, and that you heard about their story on the radio, and you just wanted to show your support.
Absolutely. Do you have a number?
The number is 864-814-4701. Again, that's 864-814-4701.
And we'll make sure we get that out. And I hope people do. I know I will. Russell, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, brother.
Russell Bannon, chairman of the organizing committee with the South Carolina Jobs with Justice. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Riders on the storm. In Judas' house we're born. In Judas' world we're thrown. Like a dog with
family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Earth. Sky.
Scientists in the Bahamas have discovered a sunken treasure of microscopic life inside what they call blue holes.
Blue holes are circular underwater sinkholes. They're deep, dark blue waters in sharp contrast to the surrounding shallows. The Bahamas are thought to contain over 1,000 blue holes, but only about 20% of these have been explored by scientists so far.
Scientists went on a cave diving expedition to collect samples of microorganisms from two blue holes close to each other. They found a rich tapestry of bacteria in the form of colorful mats of slime that line the undersea cave walls. They expected to find similar microbial communities in both blue holes given their close proximity.
But instead, what the scientists found were strains of bacteria unique to each blue hole, many of them previously unknown. The different shapes of passages in the blue holes, they say, likely change the penetration of sunlight and influx of water needed for cave life.
Life in these blue holes adapted to an environment of low oxygen, possibly similar to Earth's oceans millions of years ago. These blue holes might also show us what life might be like on other planets.
For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for the words blue holes. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Power when we all die. Power, we stand and fight together. There's power when we all die.
Modernizing America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Website for ricksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And of course, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast from the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program wherever you go. I gotta be honest, I'm a big fan of this dine-in tactic. A big fan of carrots. Get people to do things for the right reasons. And, for me, because my wife and I, we do an awful lot of dining out, and and I think part of this is, for me anyway, is moving away from the whole tip model, that has shifted, the costs onto the worker, because, I know some people who, a dollar's enough. Well, no, it's not. This whole idea that, we're gonna shift things onto the folks who can least afford it, the people who can least shoulder the burden, seems to me to be wrong-sighted, which is why I think you're seeing a lot of this stuff going on, a lot of organizing attempts. You look at New York and Chicago, where you had fast food workers and food service workers saying, we want to be able to stand together and figure out, hey, how can we put food on our table? And like the woman in the last segment, the quote I used from the last segment, is it too much for a working mother to ask to get paid enough to put food on their own table? Is that too much? Because, I listen to the right. Well, we can't give food stamps out because, those are lazy people. Yet here's another working person whose wages don't put food on the table. Don't come up to the level that they can get out of poverty. And, during the last presidential election, we heard an awful lot about the 47%. And, what's interesting about that 47% is the vast majority of those people, they have jobs. And those jobs don't pay enough to pay federal income tax. Think about that for a minute. I mean, wouldn't a good place to start be every job has to make, you have to pay at least enough to pay federal taxes? I mean, don't you think, instead of saying, well, we need to lower that number down, wouldn't it be better to say, we need to raise those wages up? Just a thought. Because here's my problem. And I don't know if you saw this, but last year, the median pay for CEOs in the big Standards and Poor 500, the median pay for the big CEOs and the top executives, 8%. Jumped 8% to almost $10 million a year. Think about that. At a time when these companies are wildly profitable, the stock market is through the roof. We're setting records. Companies are sitting on piles and piles of cash, record amount of cash they're sitting on all across the globe. And yet we're still seeing an assault on wages. We're still seeing a declining standard of living. We're still seeing companies like this Patriot thing. Just blows my mind that we would allow this to continue. And it's happened time and time again. I mean, it's nothing new. It's just another example of what's gone on, and that we've allowed the next person. So I'm asking, who's next? Are you next? Am I next? And the answer is, if we do nothing, yes. We're all next. And I look at the quote in this article from a guy named John Bogle. He's the founder of Vanguard Mutual Fund Company. He said, I can't believe owners of these companies can't take a bigger stand. He says, look, I'm shocked, shell-shocked. I can't believe that this can go on. The fact that these CEOs are making so much, such an obscene amount of money. And you go, well, how big is it? Of the Fortune, of those big 500, the S&P 500 companies, 16 of these megastars had pay packages over $20 million a year. He had 63 of these very wealthy CEOs, more than $10 million a year. The perks are back. The stock options, the whole cocktail, all back. The perks, the jets, the free financial planning, we'll pay your taxes for you. Oh, like Jack Welch, flowers for life, tickets to ball games, all of that. Wonderful. And I look at this interesting little tidbit that someone emailed me. They said, last year, on any day in this country, there were almost 700,000 people homeless. Any day last winter in this country, almost 700,000 people homeless. And they said that, it costs about $550 a month to get folks shelter in a single occupant, single room occupant, like a hotel room or something. $558 a month, they said. And according to this study that they came out with, according to this tidbit that I was sent, any one of those very, very wealthy CEOs, any one of the big, the heavy 10, any one of those people took enough income in 2012 to pay for every one of those homeless people to have rent for an entire year. And you ask yourself, at some point, do we not say that the wealth that's being accumulated by the handful is outrageous? At some point, do you go, because I understand the argument, you're talking about class warfare, and that could be me, that I could make 10. Good luck on that. Because what I see is I see too many working people getting screwed. And I had the opportunity to speak at the Teamsters Drive Dinner Dance on Saturday night. And I asked, I said, hey, anybody here, by show of hands, anybody here think that that we've had a recovery in this country since the Bush collapse? Anybody, is your life better? Are your wages higher? Are you doing better? Nobody raised their hand. Now, understand, there has been a recovery in this country. The economy has bounced back. Wall Street is great. Big corporations are happy, fat and happy. CEOs, as I've pointed out, doing really well. The tip top of the economic scale, doing fabulous. They're doing great. Who's not doing great? Everybody else. And you keep throwing out I don't know how much more you need to see than the study that Emmanuel Saez did. 2009, 2010, 93% of all the new income that came into being went to the top 1%. 93%. In 2011, that number jumped to 121%. You go, Rick, how is it possible? 121%, how is that possible? No, it's possible quite simply. They took everything and then some. And that means your wages went down. And someone had asked me, well, how's that possible? I said, here's the thing. When I started working in freight, because I was a Teamster for 20 years, when I first started working in freight back in the late 80s, I was a casual throwing boxes on a shipping dock. I was making $15 an hour. I had healthcare contribution and a pension contribution. If you worked enough hours in the quarter, you got healthcare. If you worked enough hours in the year, you got a pension credit. That's how it worked. Today, right now, as we speak, a casual doing the exact same job that I did in the late 80s, understand, we're talking almost 25 years ago. Almost 25 years ago. $15 an hour I was making. Today, right now, at this very moment, not adjusted for inflation, no economic gimmickry, none of that. $11.90 an hour. We're talking about 25 years in time. $15 an hour with a healthcare and pension contribution, which would probably jump that hourly wage up to about $20 an hour. Today, $11.90, no pension contribution, no healthcare contribution. Let me ask you, in 25 years, do you think the price of gasoline has gone up? Do you think the price of corn has gone up? Do you think of the price of a hamburger has gone up? Do you think the price of everything that we consume has gone up? Of course. And who pays that? Well, the people who are making $11.90 an hour. And how do they do that? Well, up until the Bush collapse, massive debt. So I keep asking the question, when? When will we see a fair and reasonable distribution of wealth? And for my T-Twits, yes, I am talking about redistribution. Because as I've already showed you, my labor in 1988 was worth $15 an hour plus health care and a pension contribution, almost $20 an hour. Today, doing the exact same job, you're talking about almost a 40-some percent cut. Think about that. And it's not just that industry. It's industry after industry. It's job after job. And while our standard of living continues to fall backward, where's that money going? Well, I think it's pretty obvious. It's going to the very top. When you see median pay for these big CEOs jumping 8% to almost $10 million a year, do you not go, there's something wrong? Do you not go, look, I understand the whole, we don't want to be envious of others. I get that. But at some point you go, hold on. We've got people who are working their behinds off. And look, the people who bring me my dinner or my lunch, the waiters and waitresses who do an amazing job and bust their behinds, they can't put food on their table. There's something damn wrong about that. And when you look at these coal miners who are I'm standing in the auditorium, and it's right before the program's about to start. And it was eerie to me. And maybe I'm the only one who noticed because I was kind of the outsider. Everyone in there, that's their community. These 7,000 to 10,000 people, this is their community. So they're probably used to it, but I was standing there. Nobody was really talking. They were all waiting for the program to start. And all you heard were people hacking and coughing. And not just a handful, a lot of the people. And you go, maybe it's just part of their culture, but to me it seemed, these are people who've given their lives, given their health, given their bodies, given their all to these companies, who have turned around and said, we have no responsibility for you. And it takes me back. I go back to the Rand Paul thing about Lochner. What a wonderful decision, according to him. Is that what we're all heading for? When we're used up and when we're broken, are we that easily discarded? What does it say about our society? Sad, sad stuff, I tell you. And we had better do something, and we had better do something quickly. I'll take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
1,000 Las Vegas taxi drivers represented by IPTEU OPEIU Local 4873 remain on strike as tensions rise on the picket lines. The union says a driver that crossed picket lines recently assaulted a striking driver at the Yellow Checker Star Transportation Headquarters in Las Vegas and was issued a citation for battery. IPTEU 4873 President Dennis Arrington called on the company to take control of any drivers who crossed the picket lines and make sure this kind kind of behavior stops immediately. Sam Moffat is chief union steward for the drivers at Local 4873. He says the union is ready to bargain a fair solution to the strike, but the company is trying to impose its own terms.
The company declared shortly after we rejected their last proposal, 70% of our membership rejected their proposal. The company then implemented their final proposal and declared that we were at an impasse and they were not discussing any more to do with the contract.
Activists in 10 states handed out Don't Do Coke flyers at supermarkets to highlight what they say are the negative impacts the billionaire Koch brothers are having on American democracy. It was part of the Big Apple Coffee Party's Don't Do Coke campaign. The campaign is suggesting alternatives to products made by Coke companies. The United Auto Workers Union has been steadily adding members since 2009. The union's active membership in 2012 stood at 382,513. In 2009, the UAW had 355,191 members. The union says these Labor Department numbers actually don't reflect the true total number of workers represented by the UAW because workers who have organized but don't yet have their first contracts aren't counted. Academic workers in the UAW who have not yet signed membership cards are also not yet counted. When those workers are counted, the UAW says its active membership is more than 400,000. A sanitation strike in Ohio is growing as more Teamsters honor picket lines. Jesse Russell reports.
A garbage strike in Elyria, Ohio, expanded on Monday with additional Teamsters honoring the picket line of Local 377. The sanitation workers are striking Republic Services Allied Waste in Ohio, protesting alleged violations of federal labor laws. Since the strike started, Republic workers in other cities, including Evansville, Indiana, and Urbana, Illinois, have stopped work in solidarity. The workers allege that Republic has refused to provide information related to bargaining and has changed working conditions without negotiations. Republic has said negotiations are stalled over an offer to switch workers from a pension fund to a 401k. 2012 was a volatile year for the company and the workers. In early 2012, sanitation workers in Mobile, Alabama, went out on strike, alleging that the company refused to honor their contract. Later that year, Evansville, Indiana, saw a six-week-long work stoppage when Republic locked out workers.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Permanent compensation goes, it was for my work in 2008. I do believe that it was comparable to compensation for people in positions like mine in the industry.
Could you tell us how much money you made in 2008 before you got the bonus?
My base salary, I believe, was $350,000.
And you listen to that, and you go, oh, I got $350,000, I got $1 million bonus. You got all these things by contract. Honor that stuff. We honor those contracts. Contracts for workers, not so much. And, it just blows my mind. I was in West Virginia yesterday, and it was just a stark reminder of what we've allowed to happen in this country. Sad, sad stuff. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Look, I've thought an awful lot about this situation, what's going on there with these miners and this company that they really, the sacrificial lamb. They made up this company. In my view, and from what all the studies that I've read and all of the information on this that you read, you can only come to one conclusion, that they set this Patriot Coal Company up specifically to fail, to take down the health care benefits of these retirees, and to shift the responsibility for all of this stuff onto the people who can least afford it, which are these miners who worked and dedicated their lives to these companies. And, not to mention, 90% of the people who were affected never worked for this Patriot Coal. 90% of them. So it was just we can create this vehicle to screw these people. And while I was there, I had the opportunity to talk to a number of folks who were at the event. And today and tomorrow, gonna play some of the interviews that I did and some of the just the quick conversations I had with people. The first guy I talked to was was Billy. He's a steel worker, director of District 8. Here's my conversation with Billy.
Billy Thompson.
What brings you out here, Billy? I see you're a director of local District 8 here for the U.S. Steelworkers?
Yes, I'm director of District 8, which covers four states, Kentucky, West Virginia, Virginia, and Maryland, including D.C.
So what brings you out to this event here at the Civic Center?
Well, we're out here to support the mine workers in their effort to undo what's been done by Patriot Coal. What they've done is disastrous, not only for working people in general, but for union members all over the country. And we need to reverse that decision. That's a terrible, terrible way to treat workers after they've spent a lifetime mining coal and expect retiree benefits and health care for themselves and their families.
Do you see this as finally a stand? Because, you know, when I saw that you were a member of the steelworkers, you know, I thought this is stuff that's happened to your union for at least a generation now.
Yes, it has happened to us several times, but enough's enough. The mine workers are actually our parents. The steel workers are in existence because of the mine workers years ago when John L. Lewis gave enough money to start the steel workers union, and we're here to support them. This may not be the end of it, but we want to let everybody know that we're here to fight, and we're going to continue the fight until we get justice for workers in this country, and particularly union members in this country.
You know, what's shocking to me is you see these companies that are, some of them are like American Airlines, who's profitable, being able to go through the bankruptcy process. You see companies like Patriot, who are created, in my opinion, simply to be spun off to die, and our bankruptcy courts allow it to happen. What should we as working people do to try and stop them?
Well, we're going to have to get more involved politically, not only here in the state of West Virginia, but nationally. I mean, the answer is here and in Washington. We've got to do things to change the legislation, change the laws that benefit workers rather than benefit companies who can get away with doing what they're trying to do. That's an injustice, and we've got to fix that problem. And we're here to let the world know that we want that issue fixed. We want it repaired.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But for my Tea Party listeners who, you know, some of them may not be friends of unions, so to speak, what is this going to mean to them? Because when I look at this, I see this as another one of those shifting of corporate America onto the back of the taxpayer. And I see some of this with the taking away of retiree health care as something that could, well, I think definitely end up on the back of the taxpayer.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good point. This is not just about union workers. This is about workers all across America, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Republican, whether you're a member of the Tea Party or whatever political affiliation. This is not a political issue. This is a worker issue that's going on in this country that's got to be fixed. And we're here to let the world know that it needs to be fixed. And we support the mine workers in this effort because it has happened to us, and we don't want it to happen again. Not to us, not to the mine workers or anyone else.
Yeah, I mean, we're all in the shark tank. It's just right now that the mine workers are flavor of the month, but we're all on the menu.
The bullseye's on them now, but tomorrow or the next day or the next day, it could be anybody who belongs to the Republican Party, the Democrat Party, or the Tea Party. And that's why workers in America need to take heed and listen to what's going on and become educated and get involved politically. And let's change the laws in this country that will prevent things like this from happening in the future.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's absolutely right that, you know, the steel workers should be there to support the miners. And as Billy pointed out, you know, it was the mine workers who helped start the steel workers. And you think about this, you know, all of us are in this together. And while I was there, I came across Teamsters, I came across transit workers, I came across public sector workers, teachers, and firefighters. I came across a whole array of folks who understood, you know, hey, we're all in this. It could be any one of us at any time. And you know what? The question is, are you next? Came to mind. Because I do see cops and firefighters and teachers. They're next. They're the next ones being served up in all of this. And it's something we need to be fighting back. I also had the conversation to talk with Herman. Here's my conversation with Herman.
Herman Endicott.
Hi, Herman. It's good to see you out here. What brings you out here today?
Buddy, I'm helping my brothers here. They're trying to take everything they got. We're going to fight for it.
Well, I wish we would see more people fighting, because what I see going on around here is exactly what's been going on in corporate America for the last 30 years.
Yeah. these scab hoes think the union, taking over everything. One for the union, the scabs wouldn't have nothing.
I agree with you. You know, but in looking at this situation with them trying to take retiree health care away, how's that going to affect someone like you?
Well, it's going if they take theirs, they're going to try to take mine.
And what would that mean to you?
Well, I ain't going to have nothing. How long I'm going to buy my medicine? How long I'm going to see my doctors? I got a medical card here in my wallet. Pay for anything for me and my wife. Look like people open their eyes and see what's going on. Instead of working as a scab, that's what I call them, a scab.
And I agree with you. So the question is, how do you stop what's going on, not just here, but, you know, across corporate America as we see this assault on seniors continue?
Buddy, they blame it all on Obama about the way the minds and things is. It ain't Obama. Hit the president 4 years ago passed this about the coal. It ain't Obama doing it.
So explain to our listeners what you're talking about.
Well, 4 years ago, that president was in there. It takes 4 years to pass.
George W. Bush.
Yeah, Bush, the one that it's all over there.
So what did he do?
He signed a paper about the coal, wanting to shut all the mines and things down. They're trying to bring him in on Obama. It ain't Obama doing all this.
So can Obama help you? Can the federal government help stop this?
Yeah, I believe they can.
Is there any political will to?
Yeah, they plenty will to. If we have to do something, we can do it.
So how long were you a coal miner?
21 years.
21 years, wow.
And I got hurt in 94, I believe it was. And we hadn't been union very long. They said, you know, they tried to talk us out from voting at union. But we went union. It didn't last very long, but I come out, got hurt and everything. I got a medal card for me and my wife the rest of my life.
Unless, even in the face of this, because as I understand, they're trying to take that from you.
Yeah, they're trying to take it from my brothers. It ain't happened to us up there yet, but they.
But you're next.
Yeah.
If they try to take this,
they're going to put it on us. But I tell you what, they're going to have their hands full when they take it.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for your time.
Just amazing stuff. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, going to talk a little bit, going to play a couple more interviews of the folks that I talked to in Charleston, West Virginia yesterday at the mine workers rally there to say, you know what, we want to save our benefits. We want to protect our retirees. That's something we should be doing for all workers. Quick break, right back.
I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Taft can dig and Mr. Harley can haul and Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's gonna take a line along at an 80 short dig for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Taft can dig and Mr. Harley can haul it, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Step right up, folks, and take your chances in the amazing new American workplace. Constantly high unemployment, low wages always, no employee bargaining power, a corporate paradise. This paradise has enriched the already rich investor elite and rewarded top executives with multimillion-dollar pay packages. It also lets corporations treat the masses of people in today's workforce like Kleenexes. Just use them up and toss them. After all, they're cheap, plentiful, and disposable. Indeed, taskmasters in suits have now redefined the term hired to mean that you're tethered to a corporation full-time, but you actually work and get paid for only the few hours a week when the boss calls. This nefarious practice, known as on-call shifts, is all the rage among national retail chains. Such giants as Abercrombie and Fitch, Gap, and Urban Outfitters require employees to work without set schedules and to be available to have their string yanked at any time, day or night, even on weekends, with as little as 2 hours' notice. Likewise, if customer traffic in a store is slow, retail workers who got dressed up, battled the morning commute, and reported on time can simply be sent away after an hour or so, with no pay for their lost hours. A recent survey of some 400 retail employees in New York City found that only 17% have a set schedule. Those with no set hours also have no set income and no life. If you're at the beck and call of the boss, what do you do with your children? How do you make a doctor's appointment? What if you're taking a class or trying to work a second job? This is Jim Hightower saying, this shameful on-call practice says that the corporation owns you, and that abuse of workers is a legitimate business practice in America. To help stop it, contact RetailActionProject.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Wake up in the morning, get to work and fight yourself. And then somebody tells you that you're on by someone else. So what's it all about? It's money! Work it out!
That's pretty simple. It's all about the money. It's how much they can steal from the workers that created it. And, you know, at this event, it really, you look at these folks who are just broken down and their bodies are broken and they're, you know, the wheezing, and I'm sure you can hear it in the interviews of the folks we're talking to. I want to play another interview of a guy I talked to. I talked with Tom for a little bit, and I talked to Randy. We're going to play that in a second. But, you know, you feel that, you know, these folks are, they're worried about what tomorrow's going to look like, and they didn't think they were going to have to. They thought they did what they were supposed to do. They thought that they played by the rules, and now here you go. You got this company with their scheme going to stick it to them and their fellow miners, and it's just not right. Here's Tom.
My name is Tom Ward Sr.
Tom, what brings you out here to the Civic Center in Charleston?
I come out to help to support my brothers out here because I'm a retired miner myself, and as of the moment, I have medical through the United Mine Workers, which I've worked for years. And these guys here from Patriot, Peabody, they're standing the chance to losing their medical, and a lot of these guys can't afford to lose their medical. I can't afford to lose mine. But the reason that I retired is because of Massey Energy. We had a lawsuit. Told them we've been in the lawsuit for 9 years over it. They came in up at our local one morning up there, our bathhouse, and told us, said, this is not a union operation no more. This belongs to A.T. Massey. Y'all get your stuff and get out. So we did. So we went from there. We went and filed unfair labor practices against them, and that has been 9 years ago, and we still fighting them now. And now they've got it locked up in a court up there in D.C. And we don't know what the outcome of that's going to be. We've won this lawsuit that we got against them for eight times. And now this is the time that Massey wants to bring it back over into, bring it back into the appeals court. They just keep appealing it, keep appealing it, keep appealing it, keep putting it off. But these guys here, the Patriot, now my local, I belong to 8843 local accountant here in accountant West Virginia. And if these guys lose this, battle, what they'll do is they'll put all these 20,000 people over into the funds that's now, and it's gonna hurt hard.
And when they do this, who ends up bearing the costs of this?
What do you mean, bearing the cost of?
Well, I mean, once they kick all these retirees out of their pensions and off of the health care, where do they go for health care? What are they going to do?
The United Mine Workers will put them over in our trust fund over there, and they'll have medical. The United Mine Workers are going to make sure of that, because we're going to take care of our own, you know. But it's sad that these...
Well, wouldn't that break? Isn't that going to break the union?
No, it won't break the union, but it'll.
I mean, financially, won't it break them financially?
Well, it won't break them financially, but like the president Robert said, we'll spend every dime that we've got to fight this thing. Everything that the United Mine Workers got, we will fight it, and we'll eventually win it. It'll take a long time to go to court, but we will eventually win it.
You know, the idea of one day longer, you know, comes to mind.
Right, exactly. You know, it's sad that these companies like this can create a like Patriot, and then have these little spinoff countries like Peabody, and then they which the president of the United States a long time ago said that they would have lifetime medical. All right, these people here, these companies don't want that. What they're trying to do is they're trying to get out of paying for the medical of the retirees, and it's not right. It is not right. And as far as the government goes, the government don't want to get involved in it. For what reason, I don't know. They lay it on Obama. They lay it on Bush. They lay it on the Republicans and Democrats. That's not it. It's these companies trying to get out of the responsibilities of taking care of the people that spent 40, 45, 50 years in there.
Making them their fortunes.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, because I think the thing that's lost in all of this is you're talking about people who made these companies profitable, made them millions and millions of billions of dollars, and now they want to turn their back on them when those workers need them the most.
Exactly, precisely. You said it right there. They turn their backs on them now. After these guys has given the biggest part of their lives, a lot of them have been there that has worked in the mines since they come out of high school. Me, I'm a Vietnam vet. When I come home, I couldn't find nothing but the mines. I went in the mines 40 years ago, and you know, and see what happened to us for what Massey Energy done to us. They're still trying to do.
You know, I look at this, and I wonder how much of this is going to fall on the, like a lot of scenarios with these big corporations who shift their responsibilities to their workers and eventually to the taxpayer. I wonder how much of it will end up on the back of the taxpayer as well.
Well, I don't know. I don't know much about politics, other than the fact, you know, we got a president, a vice president, and stuff like that, and we got these wars and stuff that's going on. But as far as the, I can't see that this will fall on the taxpayers' backs.
Well, because we see time and time again when companies file bankruptcy and they shed all of their legacy costs, you know, the pensions end up on the back of the PBGC, people end up on Medicaid, people end up going through other programs, and that ends up on the back of the taxpayer. And this is where corporations have gotten away with shifting the responsibility off of themselves and giving themselves and their executives huge pay and bonuses.
Exactly. You're right. But the government could help stop this thing, but they won't do it. For what reason, I don't know.
Well, it's going to take people like you in the streets and the 5,000 other people who are here to say, you know what, enough is enough already.
Right. Enough is enough. You know what I mean? We're the voters that put these people in these offices and stuff, but they seem to don't seem to understand that we're the people that put them in that position. So, in turn, they ought to come back and help. You know, the government needs to come back and help with this situation right here, and because, like you said, eventually it will come over to where people will have to go into welfare and stuff like that to help pay their medical bills. It's not right.
It's absolutely not right. Last question I've got for you. You know, in the event that this doesn't go the way we all hope it goes, that Patriot Coal is responsible and the bankruptcy court doesn't wipe it all away, what's it going to mean to you? What's it going to mean to your brother, mine? What's it going to mean to the future of the industry if this is what we've allowed to happen to those folks?
Well, the United Mine Workers is going to take care of their people. We're going to take care of our people. We have for over 100 years. I really don't have an answer for that.
Okay. You know, because, you know, I look at this, and, you know, you look at your industry where a lot of occupational illnesses come out of your industry, black lung, kidney diseases, liver problems, all of those things. And, you know, it's interesting to me that we're going to allow the folks like you to be pushed off onto the taxpayer, away from the so-called private market.
Right. You're right. That's exactly what's going to happen.
So what do you tell people who are listening? What should they be doing?
support the United Mine Workers. Support these guys from Patriot because they need all the help we got. I mean, we can only do so much. But that's what they need is support from their congressmen, their senators, just anybody that will listen. You know, they need that.
I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
You know, at some point, you know, you listen to that, and it just, you know, it makes me angry, and well, this is not the country that I believed in. This is not the way things should be, which is why I was glad to see so many people out in the streets and so many people willing to stand up and say, enough is enough, no more, not going to allow this to happen. We're going to fight them. We're going to take it to the streets. We're going to take it to the courts. You know, and it's what we should be doing on a much larger scale on all of these worker issues. But I also had the chance to talk with Randy. Here's Randy.
Randy Gray.
Randy, what brings you out here today?
Trying to get the fairness of Patriot.
And what's that mean?
Well, that means they're trying to take all our benefits away from us. Going to take off not paying their insurance, not paying take their insurance away from the retirees, and they're trying to not pay into our pension plan, and they're wanting to take days away from us that are coming to us by contract. They're just trying to rape us is what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I agree. How long have you been a coal miner?
43 years.
43 years? Are you still working?
Yes.
And so what's this going to mean for you in the days coming to retirement?
Well, I could take my pay in retirement, that delete the retirement plan that we're supposed to be guaranteed.
Something that you've based your entire work life on.
Exactly. I paid into it, you know, for 43 years, yeah, and they're trying to take it away from us. Not only me, thousands of other ones.
So are you a worker for Patriot Coal?
Yeah, I work for Patriot, yes.
So who did you work for before?
Bethlehem Steel.
Okay, and how did you end up with Patriot?
Well, they needed operators at the time, and I got lucky enough to get called. I worked out non-union for 10 years, trying to get back in the union, right. and I paid my dues while I was off for 10 years, and now they're trying to take everything away from us.
You know, in looking at this, you know, I've been asking people today about, you know, this is just another in a long line of corporations who have gotten away with these kind of schemes. Is this the first time that you know of that something like this has happened in the coal industry?
No. It happened. Bethlehem Steel did the same thing. They come by and say they have to have concessions. Then you work, agree to the concessions. You work 6-8 months. They'll come back. Well, we can't make it. We have to have some more concessions. This kept on and on. They deleted everything. They would take everything away from you.
All at the bankruptcy court level.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, I look at what happened with the auto industry, and the right wing of this country went ballistic when the workers there didn't lose their pension and their health care as much as they could have otherwise. And I see this as one of those moments where we should be standing with workers and making sure that while property rights are protected, workers' rights are protected too.
Exactly. I have a sister-in-law that works for a steel mill in Wheeling, and her husband passed away. And just this past week, they took part of her retirement that she got.
Yeah. That, to me, that's just absolutely criminal for them to be able to get it, and especially when they end up giving themselves huge bonuses to boot.
Exactly. The executives from Patriots got a big bonus, and then they're trying to take ours away from us. You know, it's not right.
So what's it going to mean to you and your fellow coal miners if they get away with this? I mean, what's it going to mean to your standard of living? And do you think this will be something that ends up on the back of the taxpayers?
Well, I don't know about the taxpayer or not, but, you know, you work for health care. And get our age, that's when you need it. When you get, you know, you get 50, 60 years old, that's when you need health care. And then you're not going to have it.
Especially miners, because as I understand it, you guys have some high rates of kidney disease, of high rates of black lung, obviously, and a whole bunch of other ailments specific to your industry.
Exactly. You work in a damp area. You know, you get arthritis. You know, all kind of ailments you get. I mean, it's just not black lung. It's that people don't understand. A coal mine is a rough industry. I mean, it's a tough job.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it, and I don't know that I wouldn't want my children going into it.
Yeah, I got a son. He teaches school, and he's going to I told him, no. I said, you go get your education and get somewhere else besides the coal mines.
Last question I've got for you. In looking at this, if this is allowed to happen, what's it say about our nation?
Well, it doesn't say too much about it. I mean, if they let us get by with this is going to trickle down to every union, Not even non-union, because the non-union people get money because of the union. I mean, the union, that's basically.
Oh, but here's the thing. I mean, the non-union employee, what they may not know is that something like this just happens to them. It's imposed on them. They don't have organizing like this. They don't have generally a voice to fight back. It just happens to them.
That's exactly right. They'd have a leg to stand on. And it's just going to trickle down to everybody.
I wish you nothing but the best, and I appreciate you taking time for me.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
2561. And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. That was Human Williams. He's a New York City council member, one of the people deciding, are they going to have paid sick days in New York? Is it going to be something that's mandated? I saw a story recently that said, you know what, there's now an agreement going forward that the council may actually pass a sick days ordinance so that workers in the city, well, then if they get sick, they can stay home. They don't have to serve food and be sick and make me sick along with them. Probably a good thing. I understand the Mayor Bloomberg there in New York, probably going to veto it. And we'll have to figure out where that goes as well. But I've got Donna Dolan. She's co-director of the New York Paid Sick Days Coalition, timetocarenewyork.org, the website. Donna, thanks for taking time for me.
I'm sorry?
Thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
So I understand that there is an agreement going forward that the council there in New York City is going to pass?
Yes. Rick, for the past 4 years, we've been fighting for paid sick days. And we have a veto-proof majority, 38 council members out of 51 signed on to the paid sick days bill. And Council Speaker Chris Quinn, who's currently running for mayor, has been blocking putting the bill up for a vote on the floor of the city council. But last week, there was an agreement with the speaker on the bill. And the bill will now come, April 25th will be the council meeting that the bill will come up for a vote.
And what were the concessions? What made it get to this point? Because I know Quinn was dead set against it as it was, a month ago. What brought it around?
She was dead set against it, I really have to say, up until 2 weeks ago. We had built an incredible coalition, and just the pressure that has been put on her over the past few months, wherever she went, she was being asked about it. There were mayoral forums, one of which sticks out in my mind, on February 28th. Up in Harlem, where she was booed because she was the only candidate on the stage of the five Democratic candidates and the one Republican, she was the only one that didn't support the current paid sick days bill.
So that's the pressure of the people. And like I keep saying, the more people we get out in the streets and the more phone calls and the more letters and the more emails, the more push and the more pressure, maybe the better policy we get.
You are absolutely right, and it just became a matter of every time her mayoral opponents, her primary opponents, opened their mouths to speak, they were talking about the fact that she was blocking this bill, which is such an important bill for so many hundreds of thousands of New York City private sector workers.
So basically, it's that ambition to move to the next level that got her to come around, which, look, I'm not against. The voters say this is what we want. I want a politician who's going to say, maybe I should listen.
But. Exactly. And the fact that 83% of New York City believe, of New Yorkers believe that this bill should be passed. And so, she was essentially thwarting the will of the people.
But in the process, and this is what my question then becomes, okay, she's now come around. What did she do to weaken the original bill?
Okay, the bill that we have been working on and amended, because we've been meeting with businesses and chambers over the past almost 4 years, and in order to win support, the advocates put through 20 amendments to the bill. And the bill, up until last week, carved out workplaces with less than five workers. And these were the, family-run small businesses, the bodegas, the hair salons in Harlem, this type of thing, where they make their own arrangements with such a small group of people,
right,
with what, how to cover the work when someone's out ill. So the bill was to cover workplaces of five or more employees, and just offering a minimum of five paid sick days per year for your own illness or the illness of a family member,
like a child. If you got like my kids got sick last week. And had to keep them home from school. What do you do if you're a single parent?
Exactly. So some of our biggest supporters were the teachers in New York City and also the school nurses, because parents were forced to send their kids to school sick because they couldn't afford to lose a day's pay and in many cases get fired.
Yeah.
And we have seen so many workers fired over this four-year campaign for needing to take a sick day.
And that just blows my mind. But, I look at this, Donna, and for me, as someone who is a staunch believer in the right of workers to organize and collectively bargain, for me, this is one of those things that I think we should be organizing over. I understand pushing for legislation, but we in our workplaces should be saying, I shouldn't be able to be fired for this. We should be organizing and demanding this in every workplace across the country.
Absolutely. And, you know, there is the national bill called the Healthy Families Act, was just reintroduced last week. And this is a bill that Congress needs to be passed. So then all of us in local municipalities and at the state level won't have to continue passing paid sick time. It should be a national bill. We are the only country in the industrialized world that doesn't have a policy for paid sick time.
And, you know, I hear this, and I go, and I was just, it just popped into my head, Rand Paul doing his little rant on drones where he, for 7 or 8 minutes, he talked about returning to the days of Lochner and what a wonderful decision the Lochner decision was. That would, if we were to go back to the Rand Paul vision, to where some of the extremists on the right want to take us back to those days, a bill like this couldn't even be possible under the liberty of contract argument because, well, the law of the land was if you're willing to work in horrible conditions and willing to, you should be allowed to.
I know. It's so unfortunate that anyone would be espousing that, that's an elected representative.
But again, what it tells me is that there's a movement of the moneyed interests pushing for this because, you know, I see the pushback to this very, seems very rational to me. If you have sick employees, if you have employees who have sick kids, they should be able to take care of them and not fear that they're losing their job. It seems very rational to me. Yet there's a lot of pushback.
Absolutely. Well, there are so many small businesses in New York City that are doing the right thing and were very supportive of the campaign and were very helpful turning out for press conferences and signing letters to the speaker and the mayor in support of this common sense policy. And all they kept saying over and over again, if you show your employees that you care about them and you care about their children, they will just be the most productive employees and happy, and we know happy employees, you know, serve customers better and, you know, perform their job much better.
And they stay.
Yes, and they stay. Absolutely. You know, we produce material in terms of the savings of, you know, hiring costs. That they would see and retaining productive employees. And so many small businesses get it, and now, you know, the rest of them are going to have to comply with the terms of this bill.
So let me ask you, I see in the bill that they're proposing that you can't be fired for taking a sick day.
Correct. So there'll be job protection. Rick, the bill goes into effect April 1st of 2014. So there'll be job protection for everyone, from the business that has one employee to the business that has thousands of employees.
So what do you say to the person who says, well, fine, you know, I can't be fired for taking a sick day, but, you know, in like here in Pennsylvania, an at-will employment state, they can find any of a million other reasons to fire you beyond the sick day, even though that was probably the driving force.
Right. Well, in terms of the number, it's job protection for up to 5 paid sick days a year. And in San Francisco, where the law has been in effect since 2007, you know, the workers look upon their paid sick time as insurance, and they don't want to use it if they don't have to. So the average number of days that are used there are like 2.5 to 3 days in San Francisco.
So they don't use them all. They don't go to the beach. They don't, you know, they don't go on vacation.
No, they have found that there's almost no abuse of this policy, and all of the big business organizations, the chambers, the head of the restaurant association, they've all come around. When they were interviewed after the law had been in effect for a few years, they said, oh, well, you know, it turns out it's a good bill for the smallest amount of cost. And here it's always, whenever there is something, a bill that deals with economic justice, whether you're talking about about increases in the minimum wage, whether you're talking about paid family leave, whether you're talking about paid sick time, it's always the business community says it is going to, they cry wolf. They say this is going to be the worst thing that happened. Businesses are going to close. They're going to lay off workers. And that's not the reality, and it's never been the reality.
No, I mean, the sky's falling. It's the end of the world. Oh, my God.
That's right.
We just can't do it. We're broke, remember? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing for me, and I look at all of these things, you know, whether you're talking about paid sick days or a higher minimum wage or heaven forbid, actually paid family leave so that, you know, if someone's sick or someone has a newborn child or they adopt a kid, someone that they actually have some family time. I know we hear a lot about family values from a political party in this country, not so much on the policy side, but at least in the rhetoric side. But I look at all of this and I say, you know, as the ground level, as the floor, we should have these things that everybody has to abide by. Just a few companies who then it becomes a burden on them, and you have this pulling down force where the companies who want to do the right thing, want their employees to have sick days and vacations and health care and all the other things, well, they can't compete because you've got these bad actors at the bottom who are saying, no, screw you.
Right. That's absolutely true. It really hurts the competitiveness of businesses if you have policies that don't apply across the board. Now, in New York, in April 1st of 2014, businesses of size with 20 workers or above have to abide by the law, offering 5 paid days per year. And then 18 months later, it drops down to businesses of 15 or above. And then there's a language in the bill that the IBO, the Independent Budget Office, for the City of New York, a study will be conducted after 2 years to look at the economy and the impact of the bill with the hope that then it would cover businesses from 5 workers and up.
Okay, and let me ask you, any sunset provision in this, any way that, let's say, Quinn becomes mayor, if Bloomberg leaves, because, you know, he didn't leave the last time.
Well, he's definitely leaving by the end of this year.
Yeah, isn't that what they said before at the end of his second term? I seem to remember something like that.
Yeah.
But
yes.
Let's say she becomes Grand Supreme Wizard there, or Potentate of New York City. Any chance of her going back on this?
No, I don't think there's a chance that she'll go back on it. What I think we may see with a new council, say the bill has been in effect for a year, you know, maybe up by the end of 2014, beginning of 2015, maybe they'll just pass a bill and the study won't have to be done because they're just going to say, you know, this has not had a negative impact. In fact, it's been a positive force, and So many businesses have said to us they would prefer that it cover as many businesses as possible.
Right. You don't want bad actors. You don't want the bad actors pulling everyone down.
Exactly. But it's unfortunate, that to appease the business community, that we have to live with this these carve-outs, yeah, you know, for a few more years.
How's this going to be enforced?
It is going to be enforced by the Department of Consumer Affairs, and employees will have 9 months in which to file a complaint at the Department of Consumer Affairs, which will then be investigated. And in other places where they have the paid sick days law, San Francisco has told us that on average they get maybe 3 to 4 complaints a month, and that these have been resolved.
Well, that's something hopeful to look for. So in your opinion, this is a good thing?
My opinion, this bill is a huge accomplishment because it's going to cover almost 1 million workers that currently do not have paid sick days or job protection if they get sick. And this number is larger than every other place in the country that has passed paid sick days. In terms of the number of workers affected.
That's impressive. So you see this going to the state level at some point in the near future then?
We see it certainly going to the state level. We're also trying to pass a paid family leave, a family leave insurance bill at the state level. So I think the energy will go into that because that's been hanging around for many years.
Right.
And then, you know, try to push this one as well. But as I said earlier, the hope is that under this president, that the Healthy Families Act will be able to be passed, and the federal bill covering the entire country.
That would be a good thing, I think.
That would be a good thing. I think we're going to need a Democratic Congress in 2014 in order to see that happen.
Yeah, an awful lot of work to be done between now and then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Donna, it was great talking with you. Congratulations. I think this is a pretty sizable victory.
Thank you so much, Rick. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Donna Dolan, co-director of the New York Paid Sick Days Coalition, TimeToCareNewYork.org, the website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Earth, sky.
Scientists in the Bahamas have discovered a sunken treasure of microscopic life inside what they call blue holes.
Blue holes are circular underwater sinkholes. They're deep, dark blue waters in sharp contrast to the surrounding shallows. The Bahamas are thought to contain over 1,000 blue holes, but only about 20% of these have been explored by scientists so far.
Scientists went on a cave diving expedition to collect samples of microorganisms from two blue holes close to each other. They found a rich tapestry of bacteria in the form of colorful mats of slime that line the undersea cave walls. They expected to find similar microbial communities in both blue holes given their close proximity.
But instead, what the scientists found were strains of bacteria unique to each blue hole, many of them previously unknown. The different shapes of passages in the blue holes, they say, likely change the penetration of sunlight and influx of water needed for cave life.
Life in these blue holes adapted to an environment of low oxygen, possibly similar to Earth's oceans millions of years ago. These blue holes might also show us what life might be like on other planets.
For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for the words blue holes. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Rising America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you feel. Radio is our salvation. Radio is clearing up the nation. So you better listen to the voice of reason. But they don't give you any choice because they think that it's treason. So you had better do.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Anything on your mind, something I said got your attention, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. And, of course, if you missed any portion of our program, the podcast is available at the website for your entertainment, your enjoyment, your information. Take it on the road. Take it with you. Put it on your smartphone. Stitcher. Pass it along to your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers. We need to be talking to people. And, you know, you look at this. The reality is we've got a lot of work to do. We've got a lot of neighbors to be talking to, a lot of coworkers, a lot of family, a lot of friends. We have got to start this movement towards saying, you know what? We're not going to allow workers to be screwed over anymore. We're going to do what past generations have done. And I go back to my grandparents' generation. They did it the hard way. Neighbor to neighbor, friend to friend, community by community. And as we've talked about here on the program, whether it's having a dine-in at the local restaurant to say, you know what, we want to make sure that workers are paid well, that they have sick days, that they're compensated, that they're not getting cheated. That's what we start doing. And we start doing this stuff because it's right. And, I mean, you look at this, all of the stories that we've been talking about over the last couple of years. You know, it all comes back down to we've got to watch each other's back. We're all in this together. You know, some of those old labor sayings are as true today as they were then. An injury to one is an injury to all. If we allow one person to get screwed over, we allow one company to not pay sick days or skirt minimum wage laws or destroy working conditions, it eventually affects all of us. And if we allow one company to do what these big coal barons have done, and shirk their responsibilities to their retirees, who's next? Is it going to be you? Is it going to be me? Is it going to be our parents? You know, because in listening to all of these discussions I had with people, they thought they were covered. They thought they had the rule of law on their side. They had a contract. And, you know, we used to believe in that for all of us. Now it seems contracts only matter for the very, very wealthy. Now, not so much for you and me. And I guess the theme of today is, you know what, we really need to come together. We really need to stand together. And I look at what, you know, we just talked about in New York, where Christine Quinn, she was against it until the pressure, until the people, you, me, our communities, stood up and said, no more. That's how things are going to change. That's how we're going to move things in the right direction. You know, I keep saying, you know, look, we see a lot of policy going through that benefits the very wealthy, these big multinationals, these big special interests who have tons of money. We've out-procreated them. We need to be in the streets. You know, yesterday when we were in West Virginia, and there's 7,000 to 10,000 people standing strong with one message, don't screw these retirees. Honor your responsibility. Don't screw these retirees. You could see the faces of the people in that building going, uh-oh. That's what the wealth class doesn't want. They don't want us coming together. They don't want us uniting. They don't want us talking to each other and saying, you know what, there can be a better America. They're much happier when we're going, oh, it's those welfare people who are destroying the country. When the sad reality is a lot of people who are collecting food stamps, they're working full time. They're busting their behinds trying to make ends meet. And the game's being rigged against them. So I say we got a lot of work to do. We got a lot of in the streets. We got a lot of neighbor to neighbor. We've got a lot of talking to do and a lot of work. But you know what? It can be done. It's been done before. It can be done again. It just takes that one person to stand up and say, no. And then for the next person to go, you know what? You're right. No, we're not going to allow this to happen. We're not going to go down this path. That's what we need. Anyway, again, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you've got something on your mind, questions, comments, something I said got under your skin, would love to hear it. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's common like the tide, the flood beneath the sway, imperial in the sky.